Hey, kids. You're listening to the internet's wettest podcast about video games, consoles, and pancakes. The SML Podcast.
What's up, everybody? This is the SML Podcast. I am your host, Joe. Joining as usual, Cole, how are you doing?
I'm a lot better. I'm not dying like I was the last time I was
on. I know, you're feeling better, which is good.
I feel so much better. I went fucking hiking yesterday. Like, I might have gotten a little too rambunctious, but it was worth it. I haven't been hiking in 10 years.
Aww.
And I did, like, 3 little baby trails, and I was so proud of myself.
Aww.
Yeah. And, like,
well,
my kids
fun time's
like,
over. It's time to get back to work.
Yeah. That sucks.
No, it's going to be good. We got a fun episode lined up. PartyCast is going to be later on in the show. We're going to talk reviews. But for now, Thomas Keene is joining the show of Go Dolphin Games. Thomas, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. How are you guys doing?
We're here. We're alive. Kicking. It's a nice, beautiful Monday. It is hot. It is sweaty. And I am ready to chat about your game. It is called Unknown Number. It is a first-person talker coming to mobile and PC in early 2022. What is a first-person talker? Tell us, what is this game? Give us the sales pitch.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, I mean, a first-person talker is a totally, well, we think it's a totally new thing, you know. The game is essentially a voice-controlled experience told entirely through interactive phone calls, you know, simulated phone calls that come to either your PC or your mobile. And you play the game by literally talking back to characters on the end of this line. You know, at a sort of top line, I think for us, like, it's we called it like an unknown number of first-person talker because for us it's kind of the first in a new genre that we're trying to explore, which is this kind of like, you know, voice controlled and narrative led games where, you know, the player is actually really put in the first person seat and having to make some really big decisions and puzzle, you know, through some like, you know, dramatic scenarios as if they're actually playing as themselves. You know, they actually have to imagine them themselves. They're really getting a phone call and they've, you know, they've really got to answer these people and really got to help these people in the end of the line. And so, yeah, so it's basically that. I mean, it tells the story of a climate change heist, you know, in the middle of the North Sea, and then these two eco warriors are kind of, you know, calling you and they need your help. You know, it's a total misdial. But they're essentially, you know, from there, you kind of help them, you know, steal $7 billion from this kind of oil baron, you know, who's hiding it in crypto in, you know, this abandoned oil rig, you know. And it's kind of like a big populist romp, like almost like, Pirates of the Caribbean or something, but it's set in the modern day and it's done entirely through phone calls and entirely through your voice.
Wow, that's like the craziest wrong number story ever.
Yeah, that's kind of what we were going for. I mean, it's, you know, it's I mean, I think that, you know, we're as a team, like, we're super interested in exploring stuff that hasn't been sort of done before. And, you know, I sort of come from a sort of ARG background, so I kind of come from the angle of almost you know, games that don't look like games, you know, and I think, you know, I was kind of going, well, how can we, you know, put another twist on the ARG thing and actually kind of make it feel much more contemporary and voice, you know, in the world of gaming, you know, is pretty much untapped as a core mechanic. Yeah, okay, Xbox like massively fucked it up with, you know, the Xbox all that sort of stuff.
But
like,
no! Our hearts.
Oh, are you a big fan of the Xbox On thing?
Yeah.
I loved Kinect. I miss it.
It was good, but it was, you know, it was that, it was like when it got so farcical that the advert would turn on the Kinect by just saying Xbox On, you know. That was a problem.
I mean, that's also a problem for like Google and Alexa and Siri, yeah, too, though. Like, that
I can say, hey, Siri, and I have 4 devices go off. Like, what do you want?
I'm saying, please don't say that. My Google's going to start talking to me.
That's why my Alexa's in the bathroom.
But, like, this is kind of like the point. Like, you know, like every single device we have, we talk to. Like, literally every single one. And it's, you know, it's also almost like a cliche in the world to be like, oh, are you voice ready? Are, you know, is your brand voice ready? And then you look at games and it's like totally not there, you know, and it was just kind of, you know, for us, it was just about colliding, you know, voice controls with gaming and then see what came out the other end.
How does the development process for shush, Joe, I'm actually asking questions. Shush you. How does the development process for something like that go? Like, how do you take it from the paper of this is the plan for the story to this is what happens when an actual player says a certain phrase?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a really, really interesting process because obviously there's no real roadmap for how you do this. So, I mean, we always sort of joke like there's nothing harder than trying to create a new genre, like literally from scratch, because you don't know what works. So you're literally having to work it out each time, you know. I mean, the first thing we actually did was we built the entire game using real telephone calls, like actually dialing your number using a real telephone service. Like we kind of did this like hack on like, you know, automated service calls, and we sort of hacked one of those systems and repurposed it for the game. And, you know, we were doing those kind of experiments at the same time as writing a story that we thought would work entirely through, you know, a series of phone calls and voicemails. I mean, in one way, the story is, you know, her story, you know, is a good example of a story told through, you know, modular little bits. It's actually the technical stuff that's really complex, you know, and actually after doing that whole process whereby we literally tried to do it with real phone calls, we realized, you know, doing anything over a real phone line is pretty much the worst possible thing you can do. I mean, you know how bad it is talking to your bank. You know how they punish you. You know that you literally can't do, you know, you literally can't get a word in edgeways before they go, "I'm sorry, I did not understand." You know. And so we
have my husband makes fun of me because when I call and pay the electric bill, I code switch to sound like the robot. I've done it for so long.
Oh, give us an example. I got to hear this.
No, it's like I don't think I could do it off the top of my head though. Like the way, give me a number, Joe.
9. 4.
That's
3,
what it sounds like.
9.
4.
2.
3.
2.
9.
1.
Yeah.
7.
Like, yeah, just like that. Like I read off and I'm like, I drop all my accent and it's terrible.
I can't imagine you without the accent.
It's really weird. And like I can hear myself doing it and it's just, I go, ugh. But like any kind of inflection in your voice, like our electric company's system is just trash. And like,
I think every voice automated system is pretty trash. I mean, nothing on the phone works really well anymore.
I think the other thing is like, it's just, there's such dead voices. It's like, you really don't feel like you're getting anything. And that's one of the interesting things is like having a kind of a voice controlled relationship with a voice that doesn't, you know, speak back to you like, "Hi, I'm Siri," or "Hi, I'm Alexa." It's really interesting because, you know, they ask you a question, you say something, you get this kind of emotive response back, and it does actually sort of supercharge the stakes, because we're actually not used to getting sort of quasi human responses. We're totally used to this idea of like, "Tell me a joke, Siri," and it tells you a joke that's like definitely not funny.
Yeah, my kids do that all the time, and then they bitch about what they get back. And I'm like, what did you think she was going to do?
But just, they're trolling, right? They're trolling.
Just Google dad joke. You're better off.
Hey, Cole, what did the 0 say to the 8?
I do not
know. Nice belt.
That's good. That's good. I'll include that in the game, actually.
No.
We're looking for one-liners.
Two fish are in a tank. One says, "How do you drive this thing?"
No. Joe, I hate you so bad.
Hey, Cole, what's Brown and Sticky?
The show.
A stick. I know.
Are you done?
I'm trying to think what other games have incorporated talking to this extent. I can only think of, I can't remember the name of it. It might have been Lifeline for the PS2. It was some sci-fi game that required a headset and you would issue commands, but it was awful and it didn't follow anything you said.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But also the weird thing is like, why were you talking to the game? Like that was the problem. Like the tech didn't work, but B, it's like, why wouldn't I just use a controller? It didn't make any sense. That's like pretty much one of the reasons we made this about phone calls is because it makes sense that you're talking. It makes sense that that'd be your way of interacting. Whereas like normally when games try and shoehorn voice in, it's like, I'd rather use a controller actually. You know, I'd rather just like press the A button because it has to sort of make it make sense. Otherwise you don't even want to do it.
I don't know. Saying grenade in Halo was pretty fun.
Yeah, that's pretty.
Because you would warn your friend, I'm going to throw a grenade, and the game would hear you, and you would throw it right at your friend. Oops.
Yeah, no, there was also like an Xbox game that did it. Do you remember, I can't remember exactly what it was called, but it was that one where there was like a guy swimming around in a fish tank. Do you remember that?
Oh, Seaman, that was on the Dreamcast.
Yeah.
Oh, I remember that one.
Wasn't there a Kinect support in Skyrim, and you could shout the spells, and it would do it?
Yeah, I think you could go foosh, and it would just... Yeah. Any of the spell commands the Kinect would recognize, and it would cast it, but it wasn't super accurate, and it was kind of dodgy there, too.
You don't say.
Why? What story do you have about Skyrim, voice?
I don't actually. I just remember it being a thing you could do. And thinking, I'm sure that works well.
Oh, man. So, Thomas, what were the inspirations to make a game so unique?
I think the thing that we were kind of going is, you know, there are lots of really good games out there, you know, and, you know, you're never going to be able to create another version of a game you love better than the game you love, you know? You know, like, you know, for example, like in Return of the Obra Dinn or whatever it is, or, you know, Hell Let Loose, or what, you know, whatever game it is that you're obsessed with at that moment, you're never going to do a better version of that. And I think the thing that we all felt was, you know, you kind of got to just really just turn the entire like lens on the whole thing and try and create something that hasn't really been done before. And what's great about that is you can't really fail, because everything you're doing for the first time. Everything you're doing is a valid and interesting experiment, you know, and actually, you know, and no one's going, oh, well, that was, you know, that first person shooting experience isn't quite as good as Hell Let Loose, or isn't quite as good as, you know, Warzone or whatever it might be. They're going, wow, I'd actually never thought about playing a game in this way. And each puzzle and each like interaction like fundamentally becomes a surprise for the player. And that's the thing we just love about this process, is that genuinely we surprise the player in every single moment, because they literally don't have any kind of you know, code for what's going to come next. You know, they don't know what this kind of game looks like. So it's just been like a really invigorating kind of process, because you're guaranteed to be doing something unexpected at every moment. And then it's on us to make sure those unexpected things are good things, you know, which we've been doing, you know, extensive different puzzles and explorations and stuff. But there's just something great about genuinely trying to do something different. And you know, none of us wants to recreate the games we love, because those games are games we love, you know, and they always will be.
You don't want to step on their toes, and or at least, you know, you don't want to do a pale imitation of something that you love and have it turn out kind of not perfect.
Yeah, and there's also the thing of, like, I also feel like, you know, games at this moment are, they're kind of like the novel was when it first came out. Like, we haven't really worked out, you know, we sort of think we know all the ways the game should be. We sort of think we know all the modes, you know. And I think what's really fun is we're so early on in the kind of the journey of it. Like, anything's possible. And it's just, you know, we can literally just come up with new modes, like new genres at this stage. You know, you can't do that with a novel anymore. You know, they've definitely explored that over, you know. But I think that, you know, because there's like a sort of set of genres that do really work, people of course cluster around them. And I just think, you know, that's awesome for them, and they make brilliant games. But I think there's also needs to be another set of people who are genuinely trying to just create new genres. And even if they're, you know, failed experiments, at least they're, you know, valid experiments to push the conversation onwards, you know.
That's something different. It's something off the beaten path.
Mm. I mean, for us, like, we really hope that other people take on this term first person talker and start using it, you know. And like, for us, it's like we've almost thrown the gauntlet down at other studios and going, well, you know, this is what we're doing, you know, and this is our first attempt at this, you know, what can you do, you know? And our dream would be that, you know, people make better and better ones. I don't mind if I'm not part of those ones, you know?
I got to admit, when you sent me a clip of gameplay, I'm not sure if I'll be able to find a way to sneak it onto the show, possibly in between our chat and the rest of the show. I'll try to squeeze that in there. Mm-hmm. But what you sent to me at first, I honestly thought this was a co-op experience, kind of like It Takes Two, where you're talking with another player.
I'm really glad you say that, because obviously the best thing, I mean, the most fun thing for us has been literally bringing this entire story to life in intense detail, you know? So, you know, because of course you are the player, but you're playing alongside these two, you know, these heist operators, these kind of two eco warriors, Ethan and Amanda. You really kind of get, I mean, what, you know, what more intimate way can you get to know someone than have them talking in your ear and have them screaming in your ear and crying down your, you know, down the sort of phone line to you? So I'm really glad you felt that, because we, you know, a core part of the success of this project has to be you feel that the people on the end of the phone are living, breathing people, and that your actions, you know, have consequences on these living, breathing people.
How does what the player says affect the script of the game?
Well, there's a whole bunch of different things. I'll sort of go into that in a second, but one of the key things to mention first is that it is a puzzle game rather than a kind of a branching narrative game, you know?
Gotcha.
Because I think one of the key, you know, one of the things that I think everyone thinks when you hear, oh, yeah, like indie game, narrative driven, yeah, yeah, like, oh, it's going to be like a choose your own adventure, you know? And it is, to some extent. You know, we've got kind of two major branches that genuinely affect the outcome. And we've got loads of kind of side, you know, branches off that, you know, reconnect and whatever. And it results in about sort of six different endings, right? So it is a choose your own adventure. But for us, like, it has to be like a game, you know, in terms of actually, you know, puzzles. So the whole game is about stealing this money. Well, each of these, you know, billion-dollar crypto wallets, you know, in typical Farcical fashion, are hidden in locked vaults that you can only open up by calling up the secret phone call and cracking the code. Right, so it's actually a series of, you know, a series of set pieces as well, you know, as well as a branching narrative, that are, you know, puzzles that you have to crack using clues that you've gained from other phone calls, other voicemails, stuff you find on the internet, etc., etc. So, you know, yes, you can choose different things and you can affect the outcome, but fundamentally it's kind of a puzzle game that we hope will give people the buzz of actually solving and getting through the end and stealing that money.
How is the game experience going to differ on mobile compared to PC?
Yeah, that's a really interesting one. I mean, obviously when we first thought about it, we thought about it as a telephone, and, you know, we really thought about it in the purest sense of like a mobile. But I think with the switch to PC, what we've realized is that you can create a much more immersive experience, you know, for a number of different ways. I mean, fundamentally, our big realization is it's not enough to just have a voice down the phone. You also need a lot of visual feedback, right? So the game is actually everything on the screen. It looks just like a normal phone, but actually it's the UI is mutating and changing all the time to reflect what's happening in the game. So if you're trying to escape a burning building or a burning oil rig, the UI turns into a map using the keypad and whatever. And what happens in the PC version is those kind of interactions and that kind of visual feedback is just so much more elaborate. You know, it's actually, the way we're setting up currently is we're setting up with a kind of a 3D model of a phone that sits in the UI that you can, you know, flip and pick up and put down the desk and whatever. But when you pick it up, you know, the whole screen comes to life. And you know, and the UI sort of starts creeping across the entire screen, and you start being much more immersive experience in the PC game from a visual point of view. Not to mention, you know, there's moments where you have to go on the internet and stuff. Well, in the PC version, you have a built-in browser and you have to make notes. Well, in the PC version, you have a built-in notepad, you know, so it's just a much more rounded, experience within the PC game. I mean, the mobile game is going to be great. But the PC version is going to have much more immersive elements. You know, in a way, the mobile version is the kind of the game light, and the PC game is kind of the real meat of it.
Yeah.
One thing that I was curious about is because the game is so focused on speech and communication and these phone calls, what kind of efforts, if any, have gone into making the game accessible for people with speech impediments or who are hard of hearing?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really like a good question, and it's one we've like really tried to grapple with. I mean, I think that there is an accessibility issue. I mean, we've tried to minimize it to the extent that we, you know, when we do our testing, mm-hmm. We test it through the entirety of you know, using all of Siri accents, for example. So, you know, we're not testing for, you know, UK, US. We're trying to test for all accents within the English language. And the other thing we're also doing is that the visual feedback, for example, is something else that should help with hearing impaired. So, you know, you see what words, the words you speak appear on the screen, and the keypad itself comes to life. But unfortunately, there is a limitation in the sense that, you know, it is an audio-based game, and it is a speech-based game. So there will be some, you know, some difficulties. I mean, in much the same way that, you know, a controller is very exclusory as well, you know. What we've done is we've switched the control system, and in doing so, we've actually opened up a whole set of people who can now suddenly play this game, but of course, unfortunately, excluded others. But I think it's a kind of a payoff. I mean, in some ways, it's a very accessible, friendly game. But of course, you know, it benefits. It thrives in the way the controller doesn't, but it fails in the way the controller succeeds. You know what I mean?
That makes sense. Yeah.
I'm looking at some of the images on the website, and I really like how the phone kind of comes to life with like smoke puffs and water flowing into the screen. What kind of weird stuff is in the game like that?
Yeah, I mean, like, so literally every puzzle has its own kind of bespoke, you know, sort of semi-visual magic, you know. We're not being realist here. You know, I mentioned Pirates of the Caribbean up front almost to just kind of point out that this, you know, this is kind of a magical realism game, you know. It's kind of like it's happening on a kind of alternative universe plane where kind of anything could really happen. And, you know, and in the UI, you know, there's, you're mentioning like the puff of smoke. It's in one of the puzzles, you have to kind of match together different elements to create this new compound to kind of open the door. And you know, you literally see the mixing happen on the screen, and then a puff of smoke, and it kind of, you know, appears. And, you know, and then when someone is killed or hurt, you know, you see a blood splash on the screen. And so every single possible way we could bring to life the action visually, you know, we do. You know, at one point the characters are drowning. Well, of course, the screen fills up and you can see the bubbles, and, you know, you can feel the kind of the suffocation of the character's experience, you know, visually as well. I mean, but fundamentally, I think what we've really enjoyed is like having such a limited palette as that keypad, you know, and just really exploring all the different ways you can kind of fuck with it, you know. Like, you know, it's that thing of like the freedom of a tight brief. It's like, okay, we've got to use the keypad. What can we do with it, you know? You know, and it's like rearranging it into a map. Like, literally just now I posted this thing on Instagram, which is a thing we're working on, which is when your phone gets hacked, you know, by, you know, forces I won't communicate who, but your phone does get hacked. And it's like, how do you make it look hacked? Well, you turn the keypad into kind of that matrix reigning code, you know? Suddenly the phone is kind of, you know, lines of code used, but, you know, using the numbers from the keypad. And so, yeah, we just try to be like super inventive with, you know, with that tight brief. And actually, you know, that's actually one of my favorite things about the game is like all the great ideas that the team have come up with in the way it should look.
That's really cool. You mentioned that it feels at home kind of on the PC front. Is there any concern or any possibility of a console version of the game, or is this going to stay on PC and mobile?
Look, I think we're, you know, I mean, we're definitely open to a console version, definitely. It's actually something we were talking about with a publisher last week, and it really does depend on the publisher release scenario, you know. Like, currently, you know, the game is being funded, you know, via our own means as a company. You know, we have our own kind of investors, etc., and we haven't got a kind of a third party coming on board. And but that's not saying there won't be one. You know, we're certainly in conversations, and if there is one, I think that actually a console element will probably be a stipulation to that. But given that we're making sure it feels really at home on the PC, you know, I think that we are pretty confident about making it home on the console. And we've already done some early experiments, for example, about how do you do a phone keypad using a controller? How does that work? You know, it's become quite a neat way where you actually, you know, the things default back in the middle of the keypad, and you can, you know, flick it up to go to the different parts of the keypad rather than having to do that really annoying thing where you have to kind of, you know, move your cursor over all the different letters, which surely has to be redesigned. I mean, that is literally the worst thing of all time. Like, every time you get locked out of your account, you're like, no, it's not worth it. I don't want to play anymore.
Yeah, I hate that. The little floating orb that you have to control everywhere. Every game uses that nowadays, and I don't get it.
Yeah, it's a weird one, isn't it? Because it's so counterintuitive. It's not really how you want to use, like, a controller stick, you know.
I know, but you know, you got to do what you got to do. It feels like this game would feel at home on the Switch.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny you mentioned that. Yeah, that is definitely where it would. I mean, the touchscreen makes it so so
just toss the switch sideways and you got yourself a big ass phone right there.
Yeah, I mean, did you ever see A Normal Lost Phone? They did that. That was a great phone sim game that was, which is basically about, you know, a missing girl and you've got to sort of find the truth about, you know, her whereabouts. But they did a great port to the Switch, which is they did exactly that. They just turned the Switch on its side and you've got this massive phone, which actually, you know, even the size of phones these days actually isn't that massive, you know. It looks like one of those new Samsungs.
Oh, God, those get huge.
I know, exactly. Good to have a truck to carry them around.
Remember when it was a race to see how small you could make a phone, and now it's how big you can make a tablet?
Yeah, those were the good old days where it was like literally it was like a thumbnail that you would actually hide, like lose in your trousers, and you'd be like, "Fuck, where's my phone?"
TV, like cartoons would make fun of it, like having a tiny little chip like implanted in your hand, and now we just have giant tablets.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. People hold up at concerts to record footage.
One of the things we talked about for like DLC later down the line would be actually to do you know, versions of the game but like played through older phones.
Oh God!
So, like, oh, wow. Like a clam, you know, like flip it up and you can play it through that. Like, it could be a really fun way of like reskinning and reimagining the experience for like, you know, 10 years back, well, 20 years back.
DLC phone skins.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that would be beautiful.
I mean, one of the things we're actually currently exploring is actually integrating Snake into the game, you know, almost like an idle game. Every time you don't do anything, Snake pops up on the screen. just to really hark back to the golden age of phones, you know, when phones were fun.
That's beautiful. You should make, like, just a bunch of mini games that you have in there that you could play.
That's genuinely what I've been exploring today. Like that is genuinely where my head's at. I think it'd be just such a fun thing. Like a sort of like a piss take of Candy Crush, like a version of Snake, and like, you know,
like the doing bubble popping game.
Yeah, exactly. or like that. You know, remember that thing where they did that? You know, that you're drinking the beer like a pint. That was massive.
Tilt the phone sideways and the drink goes.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my Lord. Cole, did you have any questions? I feel like I've been talking so much.
I asked two really good ones, Joe. I'm the co-host, not the host. You got all you deserve out of me.
Cole's checked out. She's like, I'm fucking done with this. Oh, man. So what are you playing today? What are you enjoying these days?
Well, I'm genuinely playing a lot of Hell Let Loose. Have you guys played Hell Let Loose?
Oh, Let Loose. I have not played
it's
that
one. So good. I don't play first-person shooters. I hate first-person shooters. I find them so inane. But this game is so good. And it's such a basic first-person shooter. Like, it's basically it's in beta and it's on PC. And you are basically playing as the Americans trying to take the beaches in the Second World War. But it's one-hit kills. So It totally changed the dynamic. So you basically are just terrified of gunfire. Which, you know, my issue with, like, first-person shooters is, you know, to kill someone, you go bang, 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 bang. And it makes guns feel very unscary. You know, you fundamentally, it's like they become sort of like paintball guns. Whereas what's amazing about this is it feels so terrifying. And you really get a sense of, like, you know, even the best players, if you hear gunfire, you run. And that's an amazing, you know, amazingly vibrant experience, I think, for a first-person shooter. I'm much more educational, by the way.
I couldn't play that. I have no sense of self-preservation. And I play a lot of shooters. I love shooters. But even in Call of Duty, when I'm playing hardcore, and it's one hit in hardcore, one hit and you're down, I hear gunfire, and I'm like, where are they at? I'm going to get them. I can't help it.
So, it's interesting, because I think it's like, because also the environments, you basically... The first person to see the other person wins.
Yeah.
So you're basically in hiding for the whole thing. But you're also being shouted at by a real person who's acting as commander saying, over the edge, go get him. And you're like, oh my God, the social pressure.
Oh, that sounds nerve wracking. I don't know if my anxiety can handle that game.
Okay. It looks cool. I'm sitting here looking at the Steam page for it. Because as soon as you said first person shooter, I'm like, hello?
Yeah, genuinely so good. I mean, I like it totally has transformed the whole genre for me. Like, I haven't been playing first person shooters since like Time Splitters, you know.
I'm not too big into first person shooters. I'm not just I can't bad aim. Yeah, I can't aim. But Knockout City, auto aim, I am down with Knockout City.
Which is Knockout City.
It is 3-on-3 dodgeball from EA.
That sounds really
it
good.
It is so damn fun. It is just such a fun, fancy free, loose and wild game.
You can ball, your teammates can ball up and you can pick them up and throw them at the enemy team.
Yeah.
If you don't have a ball, you just throw your teammates. So
good. Don't have a ball? Be the ball.
And I think I sort of like veer towards like some really tricky game. I mean, I really love Dota, for example. I don't know if you guys play Dota at all.
Nah, I've never gotten into that.
I'm sure enough people are trying to sell it to you. It's a good game.
I'm not much of a PC guy. I'm a console guy. I like my Xbox. That's why, you know, we got to ask about console versions on this show and got to ask about possible Xbox versions because that's what we love here. But, yeah, I've never been huge onto the PC stuff, but this game sounds really cool on a mobile format. And it's different because not many games actually interest me on mobile, and this one does because of how innovative it is incorporating the actual phone into the game.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that is definitely better, and I shouldn't say this, but is definitely better on the mobile version, is the mode you can turn on where it's call me in real time, right? And the game calls you at story-appropriate intervals, like the characters go, okay, we're gonna make our way down to the next floor. We'll call you back in 10. And they call you back, right? And it's like, or it's like, okay, we're gonna hide out here. You know, we'll wait till the coast is clear. They call you back tomorrow. You know, and there's something really, I think, awesome about that. I'm not sure most people won't play it like that, but you know, I certainly would.
Or you got to wait on the game to call you to bring you back into action. That's neat.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, of course, you know, if you're in an important meeting or in a podcast or whatever, you know, you can press decline and they'll call you back. Yeah, they're not going anywhere.
Doing an interview. It. Hold on, guys. My game's calling me. Hello? Defuse a bomb, you say, live on a podcast. Yes, I'll be a hero.
We were actually thinking you could probably play it on a podcast. It'd be quite a fun way of doing it because most of the action is actually audio anyway. You kind of literally do it. Like you could get like a, you could basically press record every time the game calls you. It'd be quite an interesting way of doing it.
Oh, that'd be interesting. That would really be interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't know how I would do it, but it'd be interesting.
Yeah, especially like 5 a.m.
Oh God.
It will call you at work hours. Don't worry.
But I'm awake at 5 a.m. and it calls me when I'm sleeping at like 2 p.m. because I'm lazy.
Day night schedules are a social construct.
Yeah.
Exactly. Blame capitalism.
Yeah. I say as I'm the one who's usually up at like 4:30 a.m. like, this is fine.
Yeah. Playing Cozy Grove in the middle of the night.
You know, though, that's what I was thinking of when Thomas was talking about it calling on an actual schedule. Like, Cozy Grove forces you into a schedule of checking because you can only do so much at a certain time. And that's one of the things that a lot of people don't like about the game. But I actually find that it's a lot of fun to play it that way because I think that we spend so much time just sitting and like gorging on a game that we don't always necessarily properly enjoy it, especially people like me and Joe, but definitely me, because we play so many games for reviews and stuff on a weekly basis that a lot of times we can feel like we're just rushing through them to get enough of the experience to be able to have a reasonable opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So knowing that it's like a drawn out thing and you're actually having to think about your next steps and take your time and plan and think about what's going to happen next makes it a little more digestible. And I like to play games like that.
Yeah, I think it's definitely like it's really divisive. Like some people, when you tell them about that feature, they go, no, don't you dare. I'll burn your company. And I think that's like literally like a legitimate perspective. You know, some people like to put things in boxes, but at the same time, why not? You know, why not like change it up? And I think it's like fun. It's fun, the game dictating the pace. You know,
keeps you on your toes, too.
Yeah.
Sorry?
Keeps you on your toes. Anything can happen at any time.
Exactly, exactly. But yeah, there's going to be two options, obviously. You can, like, you know, turn it off or turn it on. You know. Especially because, like, definitely the binging thing. I mean, I think, you know, the idea of having to review a game, you have to sit, like, literally wait, like, 3 days to complete, like, organically might be a bit large.
Well, you say 3 days, and I'm sitting here thinking, oh, I haven't checked my Cozy Grove today because I had shit to do before we could do this interview. But I'm going to check it after, and I'm on an 83-day streak. At the moment, checking it every single day.
That sounds pretty engrossing game, to be honest.
Yeah, it's like Animal Crossing, but with ghost bears instead of villagers.
That actually sounds a lot more appealing.
You have to help them remember why they died.
I haven't even done my Microsoft rewards 83 days in a row.
It's just every day. It's usually the first thing I do unless I've got something else, like, more pressing. But
like children?
Yeah, well, I usually wake up before the kids. That's the thing. Well, right now, anyway. Because they're... I have teenagers, dude. They sleep until 2 as well.
Kids, yeah, fuck them. They're on their own.
The 8-year-old wakes up at 7 a.m. and she's just like, well, switch time for me, I guess. Because everybody else is still dead. it's like everybody's asleep. I'm like, let me hit my Cozy Grove real quick and go harvest me some fruit.
Hey, whatever works. So the game is expected sometime next year. Do you have a release window on that, or is it just a general 2022 sometime?
Look, our ambition, I mean, it really depends on how we do it in terms of whether we partner or whether we don't. You know, I think that If we go it alone, we'll probably be going out in March 2022, is kind of where we're thinking. But if we don't, you might get pushed back to the end of the year because, you know, with an additional cash and definitely additional platforms, and also there'll be things like localization, et cetera, to think about. You know, there's nothing harder than localizing a game that is, you know, a 3 hours of voice-acted stuff.
Yeah, I was going to ask if there's any plans for localization or if you're just going to keep it English only.
Well, I mean, look, at launch, like, we got to do it English only. But one thing we are talking about is, like, actually talking to, like, publishers specifically in different, like, markets. You know, we're talking to a Spanish publisher and about potentially doing a Spanish version. You know, that would make a lot of sense. I mean, the interesting thing about it is that you don't just have to translate the story. You have to translate the commands. You know, the controls have to be translated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's thing that really screws with people's minds. You're like, oh no. You know, actually you basically need to rebuild the game for every language you build it in.
I would assume there's also like things that may not translate as well to different languages, like just common, what's the word I'm looking like for?
Phrases.
It's not idioms. Is idiom the word I'm looking for?
Might be.
Maybe. I don't know. But yeah, like there's just common things and slang and general ways of conversing that may get lost.
I think that's there's part of that is, I guess, what everyone faces with localization, which is why when sometimes you play a localized game, it can feel really weird. Mm-hmm. Like I always have that with Final Fantasy, like I never really know what's going on. Somewhere. I was like, wow, I'm sure that made a lot of sense at one point. It just doesn't anymore.
Yeah, there are definitely games that I have played for review where I'm like, that joke didn't land quite like they thought it would.
I feel that about Halo, and Halo was written in English.
Hear that, or playing a game and there's just constant spelling errors, and you're like, yep, these guys are Russian.
Yeah. Yeah. We've done that one quite a few times.
Yeah. Hey, they try. Point yeah. A for effort.
Transcreate rather than translate is, I think, the whole thing that they always tell you in these localization things. You're like, well, don't be too creative, okay? I don't understand. I'm really screwed. And it's like, I didn't mean that at all.
That's our show's motto. Don't be too creative.
Yeah, we've got that written above the door of our studio.
Oh my lord. Well, I know we've been chatting for quite a while. Is there anything else you wanted to chat about the game, or
I mean just it's been great to talk to you guys. I mean obviously I'd love it if I could share the game with you when it's a bit better, like bit more finalized, and you guys have a look at it. It'd be great.
Oh, absolutely. We'd be happy to.
But yeah,
we're called to work.
Yeah, that's what I'm here for. We'll test how well you guys localize for redneck. Yeah,
like, this is redneck accent. Send it back.
Well, this here don't work for me.
I said it was over yonder in the upper bottom, and it said, what?
James like, what the fuck are you saying to us?
It didn't understand what a white four truck was.
Yeah, 'cause we should have like a pretty good build. Like, I mean, we definitely have a build now that is pretty good, but a build like that we can share with the world. I mean, there's such a difference between the builds that the studio feels exciting and the builds that the world can touch, you know. We should have a world-ready build in probably about, like, 3 months. So, you know, in that point, we'll share a gameplay trailer. We'll be in a whole different kind of, you know, zone. Because at the moment, we're in very much tease phase, you know, tease the concept, get people interested in the concept. And we're going to, you know, at that point, step into, and this is what the game really looks like, guys. Yeah.
Well, I think it's safe to say we have been properly teased.
Yes.
Yeah. Too much teasing, not enough information. It's a fine balance.
We can't get too informative or our show's going to have a use. We can't go having that. We got to stay pointless. Pointless and irrelevant. That's how we like it. Oh, man. Well, it has been fun chatting with you. We're going to let you get going. We're going to take a quick break with the show. We're going to, I might as well play that clip that you sent me of the game in action. People could get an idea of what's going on with the game. They could get an idea of how it works. We'll play that. We'll be back with more show. We will be back with a party cast. Tim will be here. Pernell will be here. Chris will be here. Cole, you'll still be here. It'll be good times. And this was good times. Thomas, thank you so much for coming on and chatting with us. It's been a blast.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been really fun. Thank you. Thank you both.
Do you have any final words before we... Actually, no. You got to pimp yourself. I didn't do this. Tell us where
the elevator pitch.
Yeah, where we could keep up to date with you. Tell us where we can follow you and find you. We need all that information before the final words.
Right now, I mean, the biggest place where we're operating is on Instagram, Godolphin_games. But we've also got a Twitter, but yeah, definitely come see us on Instagram, and then there's links to the Discord, etc. on there. We'd love everyone to basically be part of the making process, really. I mean, one thing that we definitely do want people to help with is when you call a random number in the game, you know, you need to get through to something. And we'd love it if basically, you know, the community we're building starts to record these kind of messages that you get through to. So, you know, create a database of 1,000 random messages, you know, ring, ring, ring. Oh, you know, I'm a, you know, a psychic who has a penchant for pizza or whatever, you know. you know, the best ideas we'll put in the game, you know, put them right in there. So we'd love everyone to be part of that making process and feedback process. And that'll be primarily on Discord.
Oh, that'll be fantastic. I have plenty of friends who are creative that I could send your way.
We'd love that. We'd love that. Yeah. Because we've already done we've got a comedian in to do like 3 hours of skits. But, you know, we just want to bolster that kind of library of calls. So each time you call, you get a genuinely different thing. You're like, oh, fuck, I just might dial another random number today. You know, see what I get.
That'll be cool. That'll be really cool. Oh, man. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Like I said, we're going to take a quick break. We will be back with more show. Thomas, do you have any final words to wrap this up?
That's it. Thanks a lot, everyone. Really appreciate your time. So I'm just going to run you through a puzzle that comes in at a very early stage of Unknown Number, a first-person talker. For this puzzle, your two co-conspirators, Amanda and Ethan, are trying to take a lift down into the heart of a creepy abandoned oil rig.
I wish you could see this, Casey. A decaying forest of rusted machinery.
They've battled waves.
Hold on!
They've dodged police boats.
Look! There!
Now they need a name for the lift keypad before they can get it going anywhere. So they call you up and direct you to a website that has a list of all the security guards on duty.
I need you to look on the website, sligoil.com.
That's Sligoil, S-L-I-G-O-I-L.
Then, after a kerfuffle with a lone guard...
You knocked him out!
They're ready to break in.
As you can hear, no time for chit-chat. Just give us a name of one of the security guards.
So I'm looking at the website and I can see the list of guards on duty. And I say,
Trent Keane.
All right, good. Try Trent Keane.
No. Try another. It's too long.
So I need a shorter name. So I would say Peter Tank.
Okay, got it. Try Peter Tank.
No, that's too long. Anything else on the list?
Well, if I'd been listening carefully, I would have noticed that both names failed at the 7th key input. So it must be a name with 6 letters. So I say Hope Lee.
Okay, got it. Try Hope Lee. We're in the lift. Give us a couple of minutes. We're heading up into the heart of the chocolate factory.
This is the very beginning of your journey in Unknown Number, a first-person talker. If you liked what you heard, the game will be out in early 2022 on mobile and on PC.
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for sticking around. Another thanks to Thomas Keane at Go Dolphin Games for coming on and chatting with us. Tim is here making fun of me because I had to redo the intro. Cole is still around.
Canceled.
Not again. It's about damn time.
Cole, you're still here from the interview. That was fun, wasn't it?
The leaf. It was a good time. Good chat.
He's a cool guy. And yeah, he said fuck on our show.
He did. I was so proud. It's always scary to talk to a dev about a game that we haven't had a chance to play, but they did a good job chatting with us and filling us in and not making us feel like idiots with a bunch of dead air time, which is nice.
What was the game?
Unknown Number. It is coming to PC and mobile next year. It is a first-person talker.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, that's an interesting statement. That first-person talker?
I assume most people know this already, but we're just coming to the party late and we haven't listened to it yet.
Yeah. Just filling you guys in.
Impossible.
Yeah. Should have been there. It was fun.
I wasn't invited.
Well, just hit that slider on YouTube and move it back to the left a little bit and you'll get to hear it.
Yeah. It'll help us. It'll let us hear it too. And then this whole conversation will change.
Yeah. Yes. So what do you guys think of the interview?
I thought it was fantastic.
Scroll it back.
It was amazing. I was on the edge of my seat the entire time. I can't express enough.
Are you intrigued by the concept of a first person talker now?
It's phenomenal.
I feel like that's my life.
No, it really is a cool concept. I'm eager to see how it plays out. And sorry.
It's okay. We still think you're okay.
No, you don't.
Oh, don't
put words in our mouths. No one thinks that. Don't lie to me.
That one guy, Jim? He thinks you're great.
Fuck Jim. The hell.
Well, damn, he doesn't think you're great anymore when he hears that shit. Damn, man.
Jim don't know shit.
Jim shows us, hey, I've nothing but good things about Joe. Great guy. Fantastic stand-up gent. And he listens to this episode. Fuck Joe.
There's a guy named Jim listening to this episode feeling personally attacked.
As well he should.
You son of a bitch.
He's gonna write it and everything. What the hell, man? I believed in you. I named my kid after you, my dog. And then this
is like you went straight to the lies too quick. You should have started with dog. Because then people would be like, I don't know if he has a dog, but you said kid and people, I think they know.
Yeah.
I don't know, man.
You're ruining it for everyone.
You're saying that Jim named his kid and his dog Joe?
Yes.
That sounds confusing.
I'm confused too.
He was going for confusion. I mean, I got friends who've chose some interesting names for their kids. I mean, I've been across the wall. I've seen crazy and interesting names. I got a friend whose kids are named Ganon and Link, which is always interesting. Actually, that's the best one. That will always be my favorite one, just because the belief at the time when they chose the names was that Zelda wouldn't be popular by the time they got to grade school. I was like, are you daft? I'm pretty sure it's going to be all over the place.
I have some friends who name their child Ganon, and it's an Irish name, apparently.
Yeah.
I was going to say, this is going to be interesting news to my cousin Bubsy.
Yes! That poor individual. Well, Bubsy would just be a weird name in and of itself.
My nephew Sephiroth.
Not too many people are going to put that together. Like, wait a minute, Bubsy, like the game? But Ganon is like, even if it's a real name, that's up there like naming your kid, I don't know, some ridiculous name that everybody and their grandma knows and you'll get teased forever. It's Ganon.
The thing is, their family loved the name choice because they thought it was such an authentic Irish name.
In that case, and that's awesome. And then when he goes villain, they can say we called it.
Yeah. Now, how was everybody's weekend?
Well, not so bad, actually.
You always ask me that on Tuesday, and I've already forgotten by the end of Monday.
Tim, how are you enjoying the first week of wrestling with live audiences back?
Excuse me, AEW's had live audiences for two weeks now.
You know what I mean. Like, okay, 2 weeks, but you know what I mean.
I don't know. Well, WWE feels the need to juice their crowds, so you can't really take their measure. I don't know. It's good. It's, you know, it's a big part of wrestling.
Does John Cena and or Goldberg excite you enough to want to watch
wrestling on WWE? No.
I guess in hell no.
No.
I'm actually kind of excited to see John Cena.
John Cena is why I stopped watching wrestling part of the reason I stopped watching wrestling for like 6 years at one point.
Same. I know. And it's weird that now I'm at this point where he's back and I'm excited.
Small doses. I want to know how he got out of the funhouse, though.
Yeah, I know.
Like, you got to answer the questions. Continuity. You think, oh, I already forgot. Yeah, continuity. Oh, wait, they don't believe in that over there. Yeah. So, yeah. But
Arnell and Chris, how was your weekend?
Speaking of wrestling, I found my next flip, hopefully, which will make me a small cut if the truth is there, which is that, if you may recall, I sold some Garbage Pail Kids a few weeks ago, and the reason being was because Michael Jordan was popular, and it was a Michael Jordan Garbage Pail Kid.
He's been popular, Purnell. I don't know.
Who's this Michael person you mentioned?
Let me
probably. Are they as popular as Root Beer Is My Jam?
Who
subbed for the 26 months?
Let me restate this for the assholes on the show. He became, his interest has been reignited because of a documentary that was done on him. There, better. Anyway, point is, I got paid, motherfucker. Now,
how much did you get paid? Was it as much as I'm going to get paid from the sub from Root Beer Is My Champ from their 26th month?
Maybe. I don't know. Root Beer can be throwing cash around like freaking gig. I don't like freaking like Mr. Uncle Pennybags, but.
No, sub gets you like $2.50. So you got substantially more money than I got from a sub for your Garbage Pail Kids. At least I would hope that you got more than $2.50 for your Garbage Pail Kids cards.
And then here's the thing. So apparently the next one, though, I don't know. I honestly have no understanding why this is the thing. There's a Hulk Hogan Garbage Pail Kid from 2007 that is individually selling for like 40 to 70 bucks per card.
Jeez.
And I have four of them. So
Did you open packs, Purnell?
I always open packs.
No, I mean, did you open packs like today? Is what I'm asking.
No. Okay. I do have some packs I can open today or later tonight, though, if I feel like it. But that's how many I've got before opening the few packs I didn't have to open to complete the set that year. So I am seriously considering going through that and then rolling the dice, because even if it's, you know, not as much as I perceive it to be, like maybe I don't get as much as they these other auctions have gotten, I'm still going to get more than $0.00, and I'm sure I'll at least get $10 per card, which will still make extras. Me happy. Yeah. Exactly. I'm not breaking the setup, but I am definitely going to cash out some extras, and I am ready.
What's the whole set worth?
I'm not even sure. Honestly, the set itself isn't going to be worth anything special because it's just a general set of cards, but for some reason, people gravitate towards individual cards, and those end up moving because it's just like they care about the icon on the card itself. It's like, hey, I'll buy that. But if you're like, here's this whole series, that card could be in there too. And they're like, nah, we don't care about that. Give me the cards. So I'll pay more for the individual card than the entire set of cards. So weird shit there. But I just find it amazing that I am getting into this habit now where I'm going through all the stuff I've accumulated over the last 30 or so years and just looking for things that are now suddenly worth money. And surprisingly stumbling across interesting stuff like that Kirby card.
Like half your collection is worth a lot of money.
Well, I mean, the video games, yes. It's the other stuff that's the weird stuff, though. Like, what was like the Kirby e-reader card that sold for stupid money? Like, I'm going to start looking to see if I may have that fucker because I was at E3 that year. But I questioned if I kept the card because I had no interest in the e-reader. But of course, then I was like, I wonder if those Kid Icarus cars are worth money. Unfortunately, they are not.
But, yeah, nobody had interest in the E-Rig.
That's the thing. No one had interest in it, and yet somehow these cars are still flipping to somebody. Like, just the idea, like, this is rare, bitch. You're like, but no,
hey,
one
do you
want to
play Pong? Let me slide 15 cards first so it could load the data.
That was the thing that bugged me the most. It was like, hey, here's this really cool, like, what was it, when they released Super Mario Brothers 2 again. And it was like, okay, well, oh, sorry, Mario 3 was the real one that did this, where it was like, hey, here's Mario 3 on Game Boy Advance. And we added all these cool features that would sell the game by themselves. But rather than put them in the game, thereby moving the product, we made you buy a bunch of cards and an e-reader. And then hope you get the set of cards that you'll then have to swipe every time you play the game to get the cool elements of this product that should have been on the fucking cart to begin with.
I just sell you an amiibo.
Well, and I will admit, at least in the defense of that, though, it's not really defending amiibos, it's just the concept. Like, amiibos never really unlock anything that substantial. It's usually like, hey, here's like this cosmetic piece of shit. Or here's this like one ability that you really don't need. It's just kind of fun to putz around with, and it makes the game stupidly easy. Whereas with the e-reader stuff from Mario 3, it was like, these are full stages, Mario 2 mechanics in Mario 3, like crazy stuff like that. And it was like, but I'm never going to see those things because fuck the e-reader. So it was to me, that was a bad choice on their part. Like, I get the idea of trying to do something that they consider innovative, but I think that was a bad call on their part. Though maybe it was the thing that eventually led us to what is now is amiibos. They knew it because they know it'll sell to the right people.
There's no S. It's just amiibo. That's its plural. Yeah.
So now they got to make it confusing too.
Man, look at the fucking Nintendo grammar police out
and
here.
It's lowercase. It's always lowercase, and it's always just amiibo.
Just got to make this complicated, don't you, Joe? Yeah, lowercase.
It's
amiibo world.
He's actually decomplicating it by removing the S in any capitalization.
Yes. Yes, yeah, but then I got to simplify that. It for you.
Well, that sounds like a you problem.
Yeah, it is a you problem. It is a strictly you problem.
That's a fucking English language problem. What are you talking about?
No, it's not. It's branding, motherfucker. Welcome to capitalism.
You can't desimplify. It's not considered desimplifying if it requires you to go against everything you've learned in regards to understanding.
Is a standalone word
English
always
language
capitalized? If it's not,
I don't think desimplify is a word. I don't think we can trust what Purnell's saying here.
You said it desimplifies. You're the one that said it simplifies it. I'm saying it makes it more complicated.
And you said it desimplified.
It does desimplify. It's more complicated because it goes against the law.
It's all lowercase. How is that more complicated?
There's words, okay? Words. It's just, no.
How is all lowercase being more complicated? If you look at a sentence, only one word is capitalized. The rest are lowercase.
It's more complicated because it goes against a standard set of rules. And
yes,
you guys are getting pedantic on it, and
rules.
That's hard.
No.
Shit. Thanks, Chris. Chris got my back. You guys can kiss my ass. Chris is
on
the level.
I'm not a prescriptivist.
Cole. Yeah. Where do you stand on this matter?
Oh, desimplify is actually a word.
Okay, fair.
I'll take it. See, finally, I get my just due, which is convenient because I'm playing Monster Hunter. So I was like, oh, look.
Let me just grab my grammar.
Are you trying to segue, Purnell?
I actually kind of was.
Is Purnell doing my job for me? Cool. Oh, I don't have to be here.
Purnell never sets up the segue. We usually have to segue away from Purnell.
I know. Thank you.
I do it quite often, thank you. You just don't
know. I guess we just have to verbally abuse him for like several minutes on end. And then he'll be like, my God, get these guys off me.
Shit.
Let's talk about Monster Hunter.
Jesus, man. See, now I'm hurting. Now I'm hurting. My soul hurts, but also my sides hurt because I'm laughing and I'm hurting. I don't know what to make of this. I'm so conflicted.
Well, should we get into reviews?
Yes.
We dive into these?
Yes.
All right. First game to talk about tonight is Monster Hunter Stories 2 Wings of Ruin, developed and published by Capcom, released July 9th on Steam and Switch for $59.99. New adventure awaits for you in the second installment of the turn-based RPG series set in the Monster Hunter world. Become a rider and form bonds with friendly monsters known as Monsties to fight alongside them as you take part in an epic story. Purnell, tell us about your time with Monster Hunter Stories 2: Wings of Ruin.
So,
Monster Hunter. Can I ask you a question? Sorry, not to like derail you right off the bat.
But that's exactly what you did.
Is this well, this could be considered news. Is this the game that like Target didn't want you to return?
Yes.
Or is that something else? Oh, okay. No, yeah. This is the
game. So, should I go into that now or after the review?
After the review.
It's up to you.
Okay, after the review. Yeah, let's handle the review first.
This was interesting, though.
So, Monster Hunter Stories 2 falls on the long line of games I get for the show that results in me playing other games that I already owned that never opened up. That being Monster Hunter Stories 1. but I was glad to learn that I did not need to have the full completion of Monster Hunter Stories 1 to appreciate this game. So I played a little bit of the first game just to kind of dip my toe and then moved into this one. And this game is kind of a sequel to that game, but only in narrative, but not in a way that you have to know it to follow through. It takes place years after the first game. The main character of that game has actually passed away, and you're the grandchild of that main character.
Spoilers.
It's not a spoiler. It's the beginning of the game. God damn it.
I can't believe you spoiled the beginning of the game like that.
I know. Just shoot me now.
It's ruined. I can't ever play it now. I'm heartbroken.
You know, just bust out the, you know, just break out the gun lance. It's over. Just take me out.
I'm so conflicted here because, you know, spoilers and then, but what about no backseating?
What is no backseating? Because
there's both spoilers going on and the people and the other people are backseating this review.
When was backseating a ban?
I didn't tell him how to do the review.
Why?
I just told him to ruin the game for
me. I'm asking pertinent questions.
So, sequel to first game, main character, grandchild of previous game's main character, and that is pretty much why they're even important in this freaking game, okay? So, as the game plays, the idea is that, I guess in general Monster Hunter fashion, even the base games, weird things are happening that are, you know, uprooting or disturbing the natural ecosystem. And it's up to you to figure out what the hell's going on and set things right. And of course, there's other like actual personal narrative story beats here too, because unlike base Monster Hunter, this game drill boils more down to like the character level. So like the people you meet and even your character have backstories and narratives that are played out as the game progresses, which I actually think is really cool for this compared to playing the previous games in the series. With that said, however, they actually do a great job of bringing in gameplay aspects from that game and making them viable here despite being completely different gameplay styles. So the way this game works is that you are exploring various continents. It's a JRPG style as far as like how the gameplay works. You are a hunter and you have a stable of monsters, which some you can take with you, and they carry various, like animal archetypes, just like in Monster Hunter monsters, because they are the Monster Hunter world monsters. You hatch them from eggs, and when you hatch them, they have various stats like attack, defense, and they also have these things called genes, which determines any stat bonuses they get, any special attacks they might get, and believe it or not, it's a 3x3 grid, so if you get the right combination in the right order, you get something called a bingo bonus. But that goes into a whole other system that you don't need to hear about on this review. Just know there's a cool little gene system that makes monsters unique and different. Even though you might end up
drink.
God damn it. With multiple velocidromes or bulldromes in your party. Now, when you go out in the battle with these monsters, you can have up to 6 in your party. However, on the field of battle, only 1 can be out at a time. And your character also can have 3 different weapons equipped at a time that they can switch between during battle. Why would you want to switch between weapons and monsters? Well, because the way this gameplay works as far as combat goes is monsters have, you know, like body parts, just like in the Monster Hunter series, the basic games. But in addition to that, there are a variety of traits that factor into how battles progress. The attacks. There are like 3 types of attacks. Think like some of how fire and, you know, electric and all that in Pokemon would work. There's speed, power, and tech. And of that tree, one can beat another all the time. So you want to try to make it so that the attack you use beats the attack the monster is going to use. You can generally tell as long as you understand what the type of monster is and how they fight. Monsters you bring in have specific types of attacks that they also use. So you want to make sure that you match the right monsters up with the right monsters you're battling against and your weapons in the same capacity. And, because there's more to that, in addition to this, those types of those attacks, the weapons have slash, pierce, and blunt. And those determine, like, as far as like how effective they are on like, a particular monster's body part. Because again, similar to how Monster Hunter rules work, like a slash weapon might be better on a monster's tail, whereas a hard shell monster will take more damage from a blunt weapon like a hammer. So you'll be switching weapons and switching gear constantly throughout combat. Then there's other elements to this game, but again, I shouldn't go into a lot, but there's like kinship attacks where you can ride your monster after certain getting a number of combo attacks off, and then super moves you can trigger by using the ride feature and then getting enough attacks in with that, which does like exponential damage, and then double kinship attacks. I don't want to drag this on too long because I would by going into all of it, but just know the it combat. Sounds like
there's a lot to the game.
There really is, and it's surprising because I wasn't expecting that. I really wasn't. And the world as you explore is actually very beautiful too. Very large landscapes. I will say the one downside is like there's like these areas like when you go to a dungeon or a den, which I'll talk about in a second. They generally tend to be like corridor focused. Some of the caves can have like opened up areas, but there's a lot of corridors, and they can come across as being boring. But it's not really a shot in the game's arm because or foot because. That's generally JRPG 101 these days. But when you run around the world map, the way you end up going about getting new monsters is you don't get them from general battles. Instead, what happens is you come across the occasional monster den. Monster dens, when you enter them, they're randomly generated, by the way, on the maps. But when you enter them, they're like small little mini areas that you can run around in and eventually find a nest where you have like 3 to 4 chances to pull out a random egg. And that egg determines what type of monster you're going to get if you take it back to your stable and hatch it. There are also the occasional rare monster dens that will form, which will give you either rare monsters or monsters with rare gene patterns. So, like I said earlier, even though you'll come across multiples of the same monster, the monsters themselves are not the same because they have different gene pool, gene scriptures. So you'll be tossing and juggling monsters in that regard. I feel as though this game, in and of itself, is a lot of fun. I enjoy the idea of like collecting and doing like item combinations, fulfilling the quest from the town, because again, very Monster Hunter in those scopes. But due to the JRPG aspects of it, it feels like a completely different game that utilizes rules that Monster Hunter has put into place. So you feel it feels familiar, yet also very different.
I hear a lot of people compare it, like they say it's Monster Hunter's version of Pokemon. Is that?
They are 100% right.
That's what I was thinking of.
Because it honestly is. It's like so like earlier I mentioned how the attack types feel kind of like how at Pokemon has the element types. So you have elements in the actual armors and stuff, just like in Monster Hunter. Like you have armor that, you know, does fire, like call it blocks fire damage, or a weapon that can do fire damage. But you also have that tree of 3 attacks, which I guess a better comparison to that would be like the Fire Emblem attack tree on triangle. But nonetheless, you have that. And since you're swapping monsters constantly because you're trying to match their attack types with the attack types of the enemies. Oh, that's the other reason why I should mention why that's important, because it ties into your Pokemon aspect. So in Pokemon, usually the idea is, you know, fire is weak against water. So if you hit it with a water attack, it does more damage, right? In this game, there is that aspect of things as far as like a monster could be weak to electric damage, so have a weapon that does electric damage. But in addition to that, the attack tree works like this. In a battle, an enemy's going to generally attack one target. They have group attacks just like other RPGs, but generally they're attacking one person. And you can see who they're going to attack on the screen. If you know what attack type they're going to use, or you can properly guess it, you can swap in a monster that uses the stronger version of that attack. So if they're using a power attack, you want to use a speed attack against it. They go into a head-to-head when they conflict with each other, and the person with the better attack does damage and nullifies the enemy's damage. So it makes a lot of sense, and it's very important to properly match up attack, especially as you get farther into the game, and enemies start actually, you know, kicking your ass. Early on, they kind of bring you in on like on a soft note, just to kind of get you used to things and all that. So, but yeah, this game is a lot of fun to me. It is pretty much the Pokemon of Monster Hunter games, and that's not a bad thing because as I mentioned way back when on my Nexomon review, Pokemon shouldn't be the sole de facto game for monster battling titles. No. And there's nothing wrong with having more variety in the genre. And I feel like this carves its own unique and pleasant niche in that aspect of things. And I definitely like Monster Genes better than freaking Pokemon IV. So there's that.
And if people haven't really gotten into the Monster Hunter series, this might be a way for them to get into the franchise through a different genre.
Absolutely, because for those, I think Tim mentioned earlier how he tried to get into Monster Hunter and didn't like it. So Monster Hunter normal games, the narrative generally falls around, hey, you're in town, here's this quest board, you take the quest, eat a big meal, and then go to random environment to hunt monster, kill it, and get reward, right? So obviously the formula works for a lot of people, but I could totally understand why it would not work for a lot of other people too. Whereas with this game, it's narrative driven, and you're exploring an actual open world in that sense. So it's not going to place where your only real goal is to find the monster and kill it. You're actually exploring the map, looking for treasure, looking for items, fighting monsters, leveling up, you know, doing all the JRPG things that generally propel a person to play through those games, as opposed to just trying to get better gear from, you know, carved up animals.
Yeah.
Though you do get better gear from carved up animals. But what are you going to do? But all in all, I think this game is really cool. I like it a lot. I actually like it more than I thought. In fact, the only gripe I had, which again is small potatoes, is that I wish you could have more than one of your monsters out battling at one time. But in Max, you end up with your character, one of your monsters out, and then a battle party buddy, and then their monster out. Though you don't get to choose what actions they take. They do what they want to do. So, but it's still a lot of fun. I still think the game is great. And
$60 on it. What is your verdict?
I think it's a legit recommendation. It's a good freaking game. And I'm glad I own it twice.
Why do you own it twice?
So when the review came through, I had already bought it for the Switch. And I already intended to play around with it because I wanted to play and see what all the hubbub was about. But when the review came, I was like, all right, yes, I'll take the review and then take my copy back to the store because I really don't need it anymore. Try to take the game back. They flagged it and said that they couldn't take the game back because the claim was that people have been opening cases, removing carts, resealing them and bringing them back, or in some cases, wiping the data somehow while the cart's still in the case. I don't know how they're doing that. But that's what they claim. That's what the person told me. And rather than make a big scene about it at the store, I didn't want to give the person grief because she could have just been telling me that just to not have me push against the fact that the machine flagged red and was like, call somebody up. I was like, whatever, I don't care. I'm going to go and just call customer service instead and figure it out with them. But that's also why, like, when Jacob was like, you should bring this up with Kotaku or something, I was like, I don't want to make this a big deal. Look, I got what I wanted out of the deal in the end. They could have been very well lying to me because I never got a full response as to what actually happened there. I just know I won in the end. So I can't complain, because they refunded me the money, but they didn't take the game back. So I got a full refund and I kept the game. But I genuinely question the validity of, you know, we can't take games back anymore because of this thing. I do know it's happened. I've had people tell me that they've experienced that exact thing at Target where they bought something, gotten home with it, and realized the game or item was removed from the case.
Yeah, I've been there before.
Yep, I had a story.
Yeah, let's hear it, Tim.
Oh, this was like fucking 20 years ago, because I was buying a DVD copy of The Mummy Returns, so that dates it pretty elegantly. I got, this would have been my like sophomore year of college, and I like put the DVD in my DVD player. It's not working. I'm like, that's freaking weird. And like, I look at the disc, and it looks like the print of the label on the disc like looked funky, but at the very edges there was this like distinct red and white pattern that I felt like I had seen before. So I stuck the disc into my computer, and sure enough, it was in fact one of the free AOL discs that Target was giving away at the time. Also heavily dating this story, so somebody had bought The Mummy Returns, grabbed two of those discs, printed out two fake labels, stuck it on the AOL discs, and then either resealed it themselves or maybe Target resealed it and gave it back to Target And then I bought it and had to go back and be like, yeah, I definitely wasn't the one who stole these discs and replaced them with AOL discs. That was definitely someone else. And it definitely was someone else. But I had to be the one that was like, yeah, this looks real shady, but
It's always weird when you're the one who has to go, like when you get something from Redbox and it's been stolen and you just get a paper sleeve with a barcode on it and you have to
report
it.
I haven't had that happen, but yeah, that's interesting.
That's not fun.
And there's something frustrating about it because, like, you not only are you doing the dance of, like, hey, I need you to return this thing, but you're also having to convince this person who doesn't know you that you are not a bad CD person. And there's something that especially hurts you about that. Well, no, you're bad people. Yeah. I'm a good person. I'm a good person, damn it, for some reason. Anyway, the point is, I think it's ridiculous that, holy shit, that's a monster that's going to fuck my day up. So,
so it's a buy.
It is definitely a buy.
Cool.
Buy this game.
All right, next game to talk about tonight is called Death's Door, developed by Acid Nerve, published by Devolver Digital, released July 20th on Xbox One and Windows 10 for $19.99. Reaping souls of the dead and punching a clock might get monotonous, but it's honest work for a crow. The job gets lively when your assigned soul is stolen and you must track down a desperate thief to a realm untouched by death, where creatures grow far past their expiry and overflow with greed and power. Cole, tell us about your time with Death's Door.
I'm just going to go ahead and throw this out there. I fucking love this game.
Yay! I was about to say, I have a lot riding on this. And by a lot, I mean like about 1999.
I fucking love it. I don't know if everybody's aware or not, but last week I posted a hot take on Twitter that got me a lot of shit about how I felt like games that... Dark Souls, are just, like, you die a lot, and then people go, get good, but there's actually, like, bad mechanics, and the game is bad, and actually, like, beating it is just a case of, throwing yourself at a brick wall enough until the wall breaks, right?
That's incredibly untrue, but go on.
That's my take, and I will fight to the death about it. Anyway, I got called a fake gamer girl and everything. I'm not even a fake gamer girl. I am LARPing as a fake gamer girl. That's how deep this guy got over it. He was really upset. I still
people
think
don't Dark like Souls when you is. When you talk about when you shit talk Dark Souls, but they don't argue about it in the correct way because they're just like get good, and that's not the point. Anyway.
I still think Dark Souls sucks. So
I don't know if I can take this review seriously then now.
Hold on. Back up with me here. All right. Listen. Just because I don't think that Dark Souls is good doesn't mean that I don't like difficult games. I love Enter the Gungeon, Binding of Isaac. I like games that are going to push me and make me improve. But
like Dark Souls.
No. But I want them to have good mechanics.
See, I hate Binding of Isaac because I think it plays like shit.
See, I'm fine with Isaac. I think it's great. I beat Mom and I was like, I'm good enough. But I was a little worried when I started to play Death's Door because all of the marketing for the game is it's a Zelda-like. And not nearly enough had said, hey, by the way, it's kind of a Souls-like, too. And I got to the first boss, and I died. And I died. And I died. And I'm like, Jesus fucking Christ, what is wrong with me here? But then I did a little bit of grinding, bought an upgrade, and I beat the boss. And I was like, fuck yeah, I'm a queen! And that leads me to the point of saying that hard games aren't necessarily bad games. And Death's Door is hard. And as long as you know that going into it, you're going to enjoy it a lot more than if you just think that you're going to be like hacking and slashing Zelda style.
I actually thought this game was a fucking roguelike, so this is all news to me.
You know, the funny thing is that literally if you Google Death's Door, one of the recommended questions from Google is Death's Door a roguelike?
So even Google doesn't know yet.
Yeah, a lot of people think it's a roguelike. It is not.
Okay.
And I would argue that even though it's a Souls-like, excuse me, I have the hiccups, even though it is a Souls-like, it's a lot more forgiving than other Souls-like. You play as a crow who is assigned to reap what is known as a giant soul. Sometimes souls stick around too long. They don't get reaped for whatever reason. And then they turn demonic. And that's how you get demons. And so you're sent after this giant soul. And as you go to reap it, it gets stolen from you. This leads you down a path of trying to collect enough souls to open death's door so that you can reset the balance in a world where souls are not being taken at a proper time. Now, I lost my train of thought that fast.
Good job.
Son of a fuck. So you need to reset, you know, the balance of nature, and I don't want to say any spoilers, so I'm not going to tell you anything about Beyond Death's Door, but doing this will lead you down a path of, like, you know, hacking and slashing through enemies and exploring all these different parts of the world to collect these giant souls that have been stuck around for too long. So these are your major boss battles. There'll be a variety of mini bosses and other boss battle type scenarios that you'll encounter. It's a fairly open world. You can kind of go anywhere from the start. However, you do unlock different abilities as you progress through the story, and you cannot get into every area without certain abilities to open access. Like, there'll be a wall that you'll need to blow up, or you may need a grappling hook to clear a gap, because you cannot jump. You can dodge roll, but you cannot jump. Which is kind of funny that, you know, it's a little crow and he can't fly. But it's okay. It is what it is. Maybe the sword is heavy. We don't know. When you get to a new area, you can unlock a door. And that door can then be used as a fast travel point to go back to the hub. When you're in the hub world, you can, it's, everything is very monochrome. Occasionally there'll be a little bit of spot color, but for the most part, the hub world is black and white. You can use the souls that you reap from just killing basic enemies to buy upgrades for different abilities. So you can dodge faster or just have general faster movement speed, or you can, you know, be a little more powerful when you swing your sword or what have you. When you are in the actual game world outside of the hub, you are limited to traveling only via those doors. So if you have not unlocked another door in an area, if you die, you go back to the door that you originally came in, and you have to go back through the world to get to where you were. With the exception of boss battles, there is a door checkpoint before every boss battle.
That's good.
So that way, if you die, you can, you know, try it a few times. You'll still earn souls just from giving it a go. And then if you're having a hard time, you can go back to the hub world and buy an upgrade and see if that helps you out a little bit. Or you can just back out, go somewhere else and go farm some regular ads or try to solve a puzzle that you had previously ignored. It gives you a little bit of freedom to come and go, and you're not forced into the linear story. So if you get to a boss that is kicking your ass, you're not stuck there. You have options. You can try it again later. There were plenty of times where I would have a tough time on a boss and I would just go, you know what? I saw some puzzles on my way in. I'm going to go do those first. And then before I knew it, I'd have some upgrades that would help me out. I'd be able to go back and hit it and do it in one or two tries. The only thing about this game that I could possibly complain about is just one thing. There is no map. Now, given the size of the levels and the Metroidvania aspect where you constantly are unlocking upgrades and getting new abilities, so you need to go back to different areas to get the secrets that you missed out on before, the lack of a map is a complete pain in the ass.
Yeah, I can see that being irritating. I think every game should have a map for where you are.
Every game should have a map, especially if you're going to have secrets and shit.
NBA Jam should have a map.
Yes.
Okay. Well, the court is the map, Joe. It's right there.
No. I like where this is going.
I want blueprints of the building.
Yes. You need to know your exits.
You need to know where the concession stand is.
You never know fire when escapes. There's going to be a fire. Yeah. if we're going to talk realism here, but the game absolutely needs a map so that you can go back. I was playing before the achievement list was revealed, so I was just kind of like popping shit and no idea what triggered it or anything until I went back and looked at the achievement. But I have 91.7% completion in the game. And for the love of all that's holy, there's a character who gives you secrets. I don't want to give out too much information about them, but there's a character who will give you secrets and hints to where they're at. And I still have not been able to find one of them. Despite getting the hint before I had even finished the second boss, I really will never find this until somebody puts a video up on YouTube of the overgrown ruins. I will not find this secret. Even once you beat the game, all the doors in the hub, if you have all the secrets there, it doesn't glow. But if you're missing a secret, it glows red. I have that one fucking door in the area that I can't find a secret in, and it makes me want to cry. Better
jump back in and find it.
I'm never finding it, man. I even had David, I was like, sit down. I'll go this far. The hint is that it's a sewer grate that only a small crow could get into. I've been all over that level, up one side and down the other, and I will never find that sewer grate. It brings tears to my eyes. Apart from that, I love this game. I've had so much fun with it. I felt like just a badass bitch every time I beat a boss. Some of them were incredibly difficult. I've been really proud of, like, you know, I played this before release and it was embargoed, so there weren't any tutorials, there weren't any guides. All the puzzles, I found them all myself. I have a couple of achievements that nobody else has on TA, and I'm like, fuck yeah, look at me. I'm awesome.
But you didn't complete it, so.
But I don't have that 100% because I will never find that sewer grate.
Well, you better get finding it. $20 on this one. What do you think?
Please buy Death Sword. This game was made by a 2-man dev team, y'all. And it's incredible. It is everything you could possibly want from an isometric hack and slash adventure.
Souls-like, Zelda-like, Metroidvania.
Yeah. It's so much, and yet it's just, everything about it feels comfortable, and it flows well, and it's just, it's one of those games that make you go, man, this is why I play games.
Tim, any questions?
No, sounds pretty good. I'm just reading through all the fucking replies she got on Twitter last week.
People are so mad at me, yo. People are so mad. I had to mute.
Was it like a full on? It's like it was a bombardment. Like,
well, I was about to say you must have muted this because like 60 people replied.
Mm-hmm. Holy crap!
I don't know if you know this, Cole, but mad cause bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Get good.
Also, one guy said I was a gender traitor and that I was not doing any favors for female gamers.
Oh, gender traitor? I thought you said ginger traitor.
No.
Ginger. You are a ginger traitor, too. You hate your own kind.
I am ginger. Yeah. I am also a bad representation for gingers. I am what's wrong with gaming journalism, which is funny because even though I write for Windows Central, I write about digital art. And I don't know how anybody would know unless they like went really digging through my tweets to see that I was a writer.
There are some people here that disagree with you on the specific point, but agree with you on the broader point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that somebody was like, play Celeste. And I'm like, Celeste is literally the exact proof of what I'm saying, that game was just badly designed and it's possible to do difficult
Okay, wow. That is a fiery take for some people.
Did I hear that right? You're the first person I've met that thought Celeste was poorly designed?
No. Celeste is an example of a good design, even though it's hard.
Okay.
Oh, I totally heard that wrong.
Yeah, me too.
You didn't explain that wrong.
I'm sorry.
For a second, everyone thought you were shit talking Celeste.
I have played Celeste, and Celeste is good. That's the thing. Like, you can have hard and be good.
But also, like, Celeste is the prime example of a difficult game where they have a, like, easy mode in it.
Yeah.
So, and it doesn't ruin the difficulty.
Just have easy mode. It has full-on invincibility.
Yeah.
And it, I mean, accessibility options, I don't feel like it's something to complain about in Death Store, even though there's no accessibility, there's no difficulty slider or anything. But because you can just walk off from a fight and go and upgrade yourself before you go back at it, it also doesn't need it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, It's already balanced the difficulty to the point that accessibility and things like that aren't necessarily the kind of issue that they would be in a lot of other games. Like for Celeste, accessibility is a big issue because I have rheumatoid disease and I get hand fatigue. But with Death's Door, if my hands are tired, I can just go do a puzzle instead of having to hack and slash my way through something. So it still was like, I can just take a break, you know?
I mean, I feel like I've had this conversation a few times this week. I don't even know what triggered it, per se. I think it was a Kotaku article. That's what did it. But, I mean, I feel like no matter how I think about it, it always comes back to the same few points for me, which is, one, the concept of accessibility, I'll flat out admit, became more of a focus for me because of you. Like, I learned about it more so because of you. So I shifted my thoughts on that a lot more. But what I end up coming back to generally falls along the lines of, like, companies will likely make what they want to make. And at that point, when they release their product, they should not be immune to criticism. Like, right. If people come out and say, this game sucks because it's too hard, that's valid criticism. If anything, the company might be getting off on them. Like, oh, you hear that? They think our game's too hard.
There are 100% companies who do that. They do.
So in that regard, it's like, they don't need your defense. They know what they did. It's like, let people be unhappy about it. Let them voice it. And if the company decides to come back and say, you know, we want that money, so we're going to do some things. Mm-hmm. We're going to make some changes to make it better. Second point is, when I think about, you know, difficult in Dark Souls or difficult in Psychonauts or whatever, I don't think of it from the perspective of what people like to say is the gatekeeping concept, as in, if you can't, you can't, that's on you. Now, with that said, though, my concern has and generally boils down to the design of the game. So if you were to say, how do we make this game easy? Okay, well, we'll give you an option to make your character invincible, or you'll do more damage and the enemies do less. Like, those are switch toggles. That's easy peasy stuff for them to program and do. It doesn't really harm the design of the game as far as, like, designing dungeon layouts or enemy attack patterns or anything like that. It's literally saying, flip a switch, you do more damage and they do less. Like, that kind of stuff, I'm like, I'm all for it. Mm-hmm. Put it all in there. It's great. I mean, people don't have to use those features, and it doesn't ruin the game for those who choose not to. Now, my concern generally comes in for something like, if they design a game and they're like, okay, we want to put a bunch of fiendish traps and enemies that do these crazy cool things and stuff that by design of the product is challenging and difficult. Things that aren't as easy to fix by putting a dip switch in or something like that. Those are the cases where I'm like, that's the game's designed by core concept. Just let it be. Like, they're going to do what they're going to do there. And in that regard, if a person can't surmount that challenge of it all, that's fine. But again, they could throw like an invincibility toggle or something like that in there for folks, and they can beat their head against the crazy attack patterns or whatever, because the scales have been tipped a little bit more in their favor. Because
I'm going to flip the tangent toggle and get back.
Yeah, geez, he went off
to Next game to talk about is Mushimi Misama, developed by Cave Interactive, published by Livewire, released June 15th on the Switch for $19.99, a vertical scrolling bullet hell shooter set in a beautiful fantasy world. Tim, tell us about your time. I'm not even going to try saying it again.
Yeah, I was about to say, what the fuck did you call this game?
Mushihime-sama?
Mushihime-sama.
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 There you go.
Yeah.
You just got to, like, that's, I took a Japanese class in college for one semester. So. But, like, the one thing I remember from it, and I did not do well, it turns out, whatever, I don't need to get into the whole thing here. But anyways, is that when you pronounce
tangent toggles
Japanese words, it's like we have a tendency when we're speaking English, like our voices go up and down and over the course of word. But when you say Japanese words, it's much more flat. Mushihime-sama. Just right. Mushihime-sama.
Hey, yeah. Tangents.
This is relevant for now.
And I, nonsense.
And I cut myself off. Anyways.
I'm not talking about traps.
Literally no translates reason. To bug princess. So you could just call it that.
Okay, yep. So Bug Princess. Tim, tell us about Bug Princess.
Bug Princess. Oh, man. Wow. What a review this is going to be. So they ported one of the best cave shooters of all time to the Switch, and it's still one of the best cave shooters of all time. So I was introduced to this game, I think, at a MAGFest like 15 years ago, and I imported Mushihime-sama Futari, the sequel for Xbox 360. So I'm a bit of a fan. I am down with the Bug Princess. And really, like, you know, really what makes the game stand out, like, this is a bullet hell game, like, on the kind of initial, like, original base difficulty. Like, it's not that. I mean, it's hard. I'm not going to say it's not hard, but it's definitely more playable than a lot of bullet hell games I've played. I think it's partially, it's just the design of the waves of enemies and the shots, and partially because, like, your hitbox on your eponymous Bug Princess is, like, pinprick small, so it's a lot easier to navigate through bullet clouds than it is in some other games. Like, literally, there was one run I had, and I'm just like, did I accidentally turn on, like, invincibility? Because I feel like I should be dying, and I'm not. And it's like, no, I was just doing a good job. because the little hitbox was that small on your ship. But the whole theme of the game, where it's like most shooters, I feel like fall into one of two camps, where it's magical girl or futuristic spaceship. And this is kind of a little magical, but it's all, like, bugs. And there's something that's really fun and entertaining about it that I can't quite put my finger on, and I don't know if anybody really can. It's just a lot of it's like a really cool theme with cool levels and cool enemies. Like, all the enemies are bugs, like bugs crawling on the ground, like big large wasp bug things flying out, like praying mantises, like clinging to the sides of cliffs. It's all just very fun and appealing to the eyes and cool to shoot and blow these bugs up and turn them into shiny, shiny metals. It's just a lot of fun in that, right? A lot of enjoyable. It's very enjoyable just to be kind of in the setting. It's, you know, pretty. What was the heavy sigh there? Anyways.
Oh, I didn't realize that I was not muted.
Oh my god, you breathe so heavy. You got
problems? No, I was actually belching under my breath.
Oh, it, wow. It got out.
Yeah.
Tangent. So yeah, when you fire up a game and on the base mode, you have a few different ships, like bullet patterns to choose from. There's a few different difficulties to choose from. One's kind of nice, one's kind of mean, one is super fucking mean. And you collect power-ups, they'll make your bullet spread bigger. You will pick up medals to help increase your score. Different difficulties will have different kind of scoring rules. And on top of that, there's regular, Bug Princess in this, and there's two other variations of it. There's an arrange version of the game, and there is a, version 1.5 is what the other one was called. And they have, I would say they're, like, wildly different, but they're pretty different in terms of what they have available to you. There's different weapon configurations, different scoring combo systems, different levels of difficulty. There's one fun one where, like, you have access to powered up weapons from the very beginning of the game, but if you pull the trigger to activate them, it makes the enemies shoot faster at you. So your increased power comes at the expense of making the screen a much more dangerous place to live. So yeah, it has those three versions of the game with different difficulties for you to get in there and play around with. It has online leaderboards. It does not have downloadable replays, at least not yet. I don't know if that's something they're going to put in there.
What? Pancakes!
It's not doing that on the Switch. That's existed on a few other versions of the game. As far as options, you know, there's toggles to just, you know, make your character invincible, give yourself infinite lives if you just want to, like, play through the game. Normally, you know, you have a couple lives and then you have to continue and it resets your score, but you could still just kind of drop quarters, drop in the proverbial quarters to get through the game.
Rich kid strats.
Yeah, rich kid strats. You can,
hooray,
of course, adjust the screen. Normally it is at like a normal scaled resolution, so it's kind of like there's a significant border on the screen. But you can stretch it out a little bit. You can turn it sideways so you can use it with your Switch Flip Grip, which I was very excited about. And then I was like, where's my Switch Flip Grip? Why isn't it where I left it? This is bothering me. I'm going to spend a half hour looking for it. I'm not going to find it. Where is it? I know it's somewhere in this house. What the fuck is going on? I found it on a couple days later. It was on a bookshelf on a book and just at an angle that I couldn't see unless I was specifically sitting at my dining room table and looking at it. And I was like, oh, there it is right there. And then much better times were had because the Flip Grip's awesome. Speaking of things that have gone up in value, because they're currently out of stock on Fangamer. So, like, if you want a Flip Grip, it'll run you like 50, 60 bucks on eBay at least.
Holy shit.
Anyways, that's a cool peripheral and people should grab one because it is a great thing to have for lots and lots of arcade-y games on the Switch, including Mushihime-sama. Because you can turn that shit sideways and play it in a, I don't know, it just feels really good playing those vertical scrolling shooters on a Flip Grip like that. It just, it's a very easy way to do it as opposed to like having a monitor that most monitors nowadays you can turn sideways, so it's a little easier. But in the past, it was like, well, turn your CRT sideways,
yeah, you
know, or some nonsense like that.
Your floor model TV.
Yeah, it's a great looking game. The soundtrack is good and thumping.
Chris, do you have any thoughts on it? I know you picked it up day one.
Lots of thoughts, but I'll let Tim finish his thoughts.
No, what's your thoughts?
Oh, okay. I love Mushihime-sama. It is one of my favorite shooters. It's actually the shooter that got me interested in Bullet Hell. Also about 15 years ago. I had some friends that... Well, for one, a friend showed it to me. They showed me this ancient 2007 YouTube video of the same boss fight I just linked, which is actually in HD. But this is, like, really terrible quality. And I watched it over and over again because I could not believe that an enemy... This is in ultra mode, by the way, which regular players are never going to see. But the final boss, like, will literally fill the screen with giant purple bullets, like, with... barely any space to like get between anything with your even with your tiny pinpoint hitbox, and then on top of filling the screen they'll throw waves on top of those bullets that you have to dodge if you can manage to get between the bullets, which you really cannot. And it's just like, and I saw a player playing this perfectly because the cave shooters have fans that can play them perfectly. And it was just it so captured the imagination, like, better than anything else. It was just like watching somebody like be a pro at 2DX, which was also at the time. And like, I just really wanted to play this game, but I didn't have, you know, a way to mod my PS2, you know, and I only just recently purchased a Japanese copy of Mushihime-sama Futari on the 360 because Cave was nice enough to make them region free.
Yeah. And,
I was so ecstatic about it hitting the Switch, like in actual, you know, actually translated in actual HD, being able to be played on a TV or portably and in Tate mode. And, yeah, it's just like, this is a, this game is literally a dream come true for me, like 14 at least years in the making. So I honestly didn't want to even review it myself, because you hear me gushing about this now. Like, I cannot dial this down, my excitement for Mushihime-sama. It is one of the best shooters of all time, and I'm super glad that it's here.
Well, then $20, I need a verdict from the both of you.
Yeah, yes, you should buy this. Like,
yeah,
you know, like I said,
I already bought it.
Yeah, it is. It was already on my wish list. I hadn't bought it yet, but I was certainly planning on it. But yeah, like, it is just an incredible shooter. Like I said, one of the best of all time.
It's a magical, mesmerizing game. I love it so much. Mm. And if they come out with a physical version too, I'm going to buy that too.
Yeah, I probably will too. Yeah. Naga Futari over here on the Switch as well.
Yeah. And other cave shooters too.
Sure. Yeah, bring them all over.
Yeah, bring them. Yeah, yeah. Bring all of them. Bring them everywhere too. Don't just leave them on the Switch. Bring them to PlayStation. Bring them to Xbox.
The Switch is already becoming one of the best shmup systems in modern times. So, I mean, just keep them coming. we'll keep buying them.
Yeah.
You know what else keeps coming to the Switch? Super NES games to the online service. Some breaking news.
Oh, I love it.
I'm so happy. Three games are being added to the Super Nintendo lineup.
I won't even look.
I'm just going to read my tweet out loud whenever you talk about them.
No. I don't know yet, so surprise me.
Okay.
All right. First one, Claymates.
All right. Okay.
Second,
play in the house.
Jelly Boy.
I'm sorry, what?
Jelly Boy.
Jelly Boy.
In this platforming game, originally released exclusively in Europe in 95, you are Jelly Boy, candy given the spark of life by the power of lightning.
All right, I'm into it.
Or as they call it in Japan, Jerry Boy.
Jerry Boy.
I'm not even kidding. Like, it's called Jerry Boy. And I think in the US it came out as Smart Ball.
Hmm. Oh, it's Smart Ball? I played Smart Ball.
I think it's Smart Ball. I could be wrong.
I'm gonna look at Jelly Boy. No, oh my God, this guy, that is a naked man.
What?
he looks like a chewing gum given shape. That is disgusting. It is not Smart Ball. No, this is something far worse. Oh, this is a nightmare. Oh, this makes me uncomfortable. Okay. Oh my God, why does he do that? Holy crap. I can't. This doesn't look appropriate for children.
What the fuck?
Oh my God. His, like, stomach punches people.
Rated M for mature.
Or, you know, or it's his jelly boner.
Dick punching.
He is definitely
dick punching.
Shit. What the fuck is that game?
Jelly Boy is joining. And then the third game is Bomboozle.
Also known as Kablooey.
Okay, yeah.
And I'm sure about that one.
Oh yeah, I remember. That was like a launch game.
It was very early, and yeah, it was from Kemco.
Yeah,
it came out alongside Lagoon, I think.
Oh geez.
Okay. Yeah, that is, and no NES game in this lineup.
Nope. Fuck you.
Oh man, the mentions on that tweet have got to be amazing.
Oh, man. So, yeah, Claymates, Jelly Boy, and Bomboozle joining the SNES Online lineup.
So, what I tweeted about this, and to date, it's still my only thought. I said, anyways, I like to call this collection, Blockbuster didn't have the one I wanted.
That is very accurate. Yeah, usually I am pretty forgiving of their the games they add, because I enjoy the weird offbeat stuff, but man, this
was not Final Fantasy 3, Chrono Trigger, and Earthbound.
No, you need like one anchor in there, you know, like maybe that's Claymates, I guess,
holding down the fort.
I'm trying to remember if I'm pretty sure I did rent Claymates at some point. Pretty sure.
Oh Lord. All right, well, that is it for you, Tim. I guess we will let you get going.
Yeah. Sounds good. All right. Good
stuff. Do you have any final words before we let you go?
No, I'm not gonna poke the Dark Souls bear. I'm just gonna go to bed. All right, good night.
Laters. Next game to talk about is called Batbarian Testament of the Primordials, developed by Unspeakable Pixels, published by Dangan Entertainment, released July 15th on Xbox One and PS4 for $19.99. Batbarian Testament of the Primordials is a snarky action-adventure puzzle game with a good dose of humor. Explore hundreds of secret-filled rooms, fight big bosses, gather companions for your party, and use the powers of your Pip, your bat buddy, to solve puzzles and escape the abyss. Pernell, tell us about your time with Batbarian Testament of the Primordials.
Well, Batbarian starts off in earnest with your main character that you choose at the beginning, either a male or female barbarian, being tossed into a deep, dark cave. And immediately, said barbarian, along with their illuminated bat friend, need to work together to escape from the depths of the pit that they've fallen into. This escape takes place by journeying through a myriad of different rooms, which forms a very large labyrinth, where you go from room to room, platforming and hacking and slashing enemies to their doom. However, there are a few interesting and unique elements to this game.
Unique drink.
Stand out from, I guess, the norm of this genre of gameplay, which is that the bat friend is used to great effect. By default, when you first come in, the bat is an illuminated bat, very bright. The cave you are in is very dark. So when you set the brightness setting in this game, it's for a very good reason, because you are meant to not be able to see a lot of what you're doing. So what happens is you have like a light radius around your character, and the bat has a light radius around itself. When you throw, there's like a specific berry that you can throw, which is essentially the bat's favorite food. And when you throw the fruit, the bat will go towards where the fruit lands and thereby dragging the light with it, which means you'll be using the bat to see your way around the cave and all the dark rooms that are possessed within it. So it's an interesting take on the game, because you can't necessarily just like blitz through the stuff. You have to actually work hard at properly manipulating the bat to get around and do things. Second aspect of this game I think is pretty interesting and unique is that it is a very challenging game for this genre of game. Like, it's not easy at all. The platforming that they put in here is legitimately meant to throw a lot of players off, and you will die a fair bit of times here. Now, none of the deaths feel particularly cheap, and I do feel as though the reward for pulling it off is worth this weight in gold, because it's kind of fun to go around discovering things in this game and, you know, unlocking secrets and new items or finding items, which the game wants to emphasize that too, because the experience system in this game rewards you for finding those secrets and treasure chests that are hidden and out of the beaten path. Because whenever you find a secret room or secret item, you gain experience points for it. You may well get experience from killing enemies too, but I honestly have no idea, because they don't give you a number indicating that. But whenever you find a secret, you get experience points. And after a certain amount of experience, you level up. And when you level up, you have three stats you can level up: strength, defense, and awareness. And you can level up three of them per level down by way of a sort of roulette machine. That's not hard to time, mind you, but it's a roulette machine that you stop and determines if you get a stat bump in certain things. Now, as you're exploring this place, this dungeon, there are general upgrades you'll come across here and there, you know, boots for sprinting and gems for trading. You also find additional berries which you can use to manipulate the bat in different ways. Like, there's one berry that you can throw where it sticks to a surface and the bat hates it so much it just slams into it, destroys whatever it lands on. So it's good for destroying blocks that you can't aim at. And there's also one where it'll stick to the wall. So if you need the light to stay in an environment for a certain period of time, the bat will hang out there nibbling on the fruit while you do what you got to do. And the light will do all kinds of cool stuff aside from just the usual lighting a path. Sometimes it triggers switches. Sometimes it freaks monsters out. Sometimes it freezes monsters so you can actually use them as platforms, etc., etc. And later on, you'll eventually get new auras, which the bat can use to do other things, elemental things, like burn objects or freeze things. So that'll be pretty cool. And the last thing you can generally, two things you can generally find in the game are party members, quote unquote. Every once in a while, you'll come across a person who will tag along with you in the dungeon. That person has an ability that they can activate by pressing the Y button, as long as they have the energy to do so. If they don't, you kill a few enemies until you charge it back up, and boom, they can do it again. The ability is pretty much the only real way you'll get to do alternate attacks, because the barbarian only hacks and slashes. He is a barbarian, or she is a barbarian through and through. So no projectiles for you, only smashy, smashy. But your companions can kind of fill that void for you a little bit. You'll find those guys. The dungeon itself also, again, is very secret-ridden. There are a lot of markers you can place on the rooms when you bring up the map, and you'll be utilizing those markers, whether it's a treasure chest you don't know how to get to that you might have to come back to later, or a shop that you might want to remember where it's located so you can come back to it later. There's a lot going on in this game. And I think the thing that's worth pointing out last but not least that makes this game stand out, in my opinion, is the humor element. This game is very funny. It's well written in that regard. It's not humor that's, you know, stupid her-her-der humor. It's humor that's written well in the flavor text. Your barbarian is a barbarian through and through. They hate wizards. They comment on magic, how much they hate it. You always have something you can say that has humor to it, and it doesn't really hurt the game in any way to use it. It just creates new dialogue trees for you to interact with characters on. It's a great time. I genuinely find myself happy with this game. I already purchased it on the Switch. I don't regret that because I like it that much. And having it available on the Xbox for new players is that much better. I think it's a solid buy. And quite frankly, anybody who's interested in platform adventure puzzle games should pick this up.
I want to point out that absolutely everyone should, because if you're worried about the difficulty in the game, or if you're worried about the darkness of the game, there are assists that you can enable. And to my knowledge, it doesn't affect achievements at all, because I've been unlocking achievements. They have assists to increase the ambient light, for slow motion aiming, for boosted experience, boosted attack and defense. So if you're worried about the difficulty playing this game, there are plenty, plenty of assists to make it easier and more manageable to get into, a whole bunch that you could select, pick and choose. It's really cool that they went that extra mile.
Exactly. I think this is a very good example of wish I had this conversation during this review. This is a good example of the toggle switch option that we were talking about before, in that the game is genuinely challenging if you don't use the assist by design. With that said, though, if you do use the assist, the game itself doesn't change. It just takes concessions to make it more accessible for you, the player.
Yeah.
And people who want to continue playing it as it is are in no way impacted by those things being available in the game for people to use.
Yeah, good thing we used that tangent on another reason. just scroll back like 20 minutes and you'll find it. But next game to talk about is called Indigo 7 Quest of Love, developed and published by Dolores Entertainment, released July 8th on Xbox One for $14.99. Easy to learn, hard to master, Indigo 7 is a fast-paced multiplayer puzzle game for up to 4 players with a cool single-player story mode. Bull, tell us about it.
I can tell you that I have never, ever played or seen or read Scott Pilgrim versus the World, but as soon as I loaded this up, I realized that this is basically a poor man's Scott Pilgrim.
Oh, God.
It looks like every scene I have ever seen from Scott Pilgrim, like any image, any still, that comic book style storytelling.
So it looks like a comic book.
But not, I mean, even the character looks like Scott Pilgrim. Like, it's all a little too close.
I think he looks kind of like Nestor from the old Nintendo Power.
Nest Pilgrim.
Maybe. I don't know who that is.
Like Nestor's Funky Bowling.
Yeah.
Right.
Anyway, it's a little too close for comfort for my liking. Given that the whole story is about a goofy little garage band and, like, the lead singer's girlfriend says, "I hate your music." And then they go on vacation. He's like, you know, "I'm gonna like find a new lover." And it's a very weird story. And I checked out kind of quick. I feel a little bad about it, but sometimes that's just the way the cookie crumbles. It got to a point where I was like, I just, I just want to play the actual game itself. So in between the little comic booky cutscenes of this love story gone awry, you'll play a matching type of game. This is gonna sound kind of hard to describe and not at the same time. Like, as soon as you see it, you're like, yeah, that makes sense. But you'll be given a grid, basically, and there are little colored dots that are all connected, and you'll start off in the beginning with like three colored dots, and at the bottom you'll have the color options and you can flip between them, and your goal is basically to select one of the colors and then put your face on that color, and then you'll be able to select any of the other colors that are touching the ones that have your face. And eventually, you want your face across the whole grid. Make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So, you'll want to rack up a combo as you're doing this. So, the first set of colors that you want to choose, let's say you pick yellow, and there's two yellows. Then the next time you're going to pick orange, but in order to get the combo to go up, you need there to be three oranges. Then the next time you're going to go for green, so you need to choose four. There need to be four greens connected. This helps raise up your combo. Now, if you make a big leap and you go, okay, well, I've got two yellows, and then I'm going to pick orange, and there's nine orange. If you want the combo to continue, you're going to have to choose 10 greens.
Yeah.
Okay, so the whole point of this basically boils down to how fast can you count the colors, right? Because in addition to being, to having to keep that combo going, excuse me, I still have the hiccups. in order to keep that combo going, you're also racing against the clock, but you're also playing, if you're playing adventure, you're playing against a computer or maybe even up to three. So the computer, they're cheating bastards. They're always going to outcount you. And then you have the element of your board is random. And I don't know if the devs mean for there to be levels that are unbeatable, but there are 100% circumstances where you get a board where it is not possible to actually clear it within the number of moves you're given and the time limit. And then to top it off, sometimes if the computer clears theirs before you use up all your moves, it doesn't matter. It's time over. You don't get to continue using your moves. It's just the computer may knock out 10 moves and you may have only used five, but they cleared first, so you don't get to keep going. So whatever score you rack up, that's that. Then that insult to injury, there were times where I won all five rounds only to come in fourth place and still lose.
How?
Because the computer would rack up higher combos than me so that it would have more points. Because it could do it more quickly than I could. So it was racking up these giant combos, whereas I was trying to just completely take over the board within the number of allowable moves and before the computer could end the game on me. But the computer had racked up high enough combos that even though I won all five rounds, I would come in last place and lose. That's not fair.
No.
That is unbalanced, and that means your game needs some work. I like the actual gameplay concept. And they did some really interesting twists to it. Sometimes you have unlimited moves. Sometimes you have unlimited timers. There's one sequence of battles where you start at one corner of a giant grid and the computer starts at another corner of a giant grid. And you're battling back and forth to try to take control and get as much of the grid as you can for yourself. And it doesn't end until the entire grid is covered. But if the computer is one color, that disables a color for you and vice versa. That's a really cool concept. And it was really done well. But you would still just lose because the computer is always going to be able to math it out faster than you. So the actual gameplay falls apart because the computer balance is off. You just can't keep up with it. Yeah. And I say that even though I made it through the first four acts of the game, I just got tired of fighting with it and haven't even finished Act 5 yet. There's five acts to the story, and that's fine. To go back to getting frustrated and knowing the computer is going to beat you and stuff, if you see that you have a board, I'm a be honest, you can pause the game and still see your board, and that's the only reason I managed to get where I did. Because I would just sit, I had a piece of paper, and I would pause, and I would write out the color pattern and math it out, and then I would just input it really quickly. It's the only way I could do it. Now, if you see that you have a board that you're not going to be able to complete, and that happened. There were times where, even with mathing it out, I couldn't, while the game was paused, had a piece of paper planning it out, and I would still see that it was not possible to beat that board within the set number of moves I had. So you can't just press a button to restart. There is no quick restart. You have to go all the way back out to the main menu and reselect the act and reselect the chapter and do it again.
I guess that kind of makes sense because it has to reload everything.
I don't see why they couldn't just do a start.
I don't know. I didn't develop the game, so.
Yeah. That's why I
hate commenting on stuff like that, because I don't know how difficult it would be to,
I know. But if I were going to request anything to make this game improved, quick start is going to be at the top of the list.
Yeah.
Right alongside of better CPU balancing, because the computers are cheating. There's just no, it shouldn't be to a point where I have to pause your game and plan out my moves in advance before I can continue. That shouldn't be, you should never have an instance where somebody wins five times in a row and still loses.
Yeah. Well, $15 on it. What do you think?
I'm going to go with a try it, just because the concept is cool. And I think the idea is there. I even love, one of the characters is very verbally bisexual, and I can't, shout out to that. Like, that's great. Character representation is decent. It's just that, man, it really just needs some balance and some quality of life improvements to be a better game.
Arnell, any questions? I know you were interested in this one.
Arnell died.
Really? No. No, I honestly don't have any. I'm just kind of, now I'm anxious because I actually bought it on a whim, thinking, you know, it might be on the level. But
you always listen to me before you buy something on a whim.
I bought it too because it was Target on sale.
Target ain't taking it back.
Well, that's a relief, because if they actually took this back, there'd be some exploitations to be made. You take back digital purchases? Shit. But yeah, this, on the positive, it was cheap enough. It's not going to harm me to give it a shot. But because it reminded me of an old game I had called Get Colonies, where you collect, you captured balls by, you know, stepping next to them, and you like link the colors together and all that.
Yeah.
I was like, this could be cool. But
like the idea itself is there. It's just that quality of life and balance are important too.
Yeah, that's true. Because I know there are more than a few games out there where, due to the idea that it's just a matter of like spotting a pattern and selecting it, AI can generally just like mop the floor with human players.
Mm-hmm.
So making the right balance there is not easy. Because
there's games like Puzzle Quest where the computer actively knows the pieces that are coming down and cheats.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Fuckers.
Man, that's a pain.
Anyway, next game to talk about is called Within the Blade, developed by Amatus Studio, published by Rattle Lake Games, released July 16th for $10.99. In 1560 AD, Japan's last shogunate has lost full control over the realm, causing a plunge into a massive civil war. All hope lies within the ninja clan Black Lotus to sabotage and defend against the forces of the villain and his demonic allies. The warlord must be assassinated. Do you have the ninja skills to save medieval Japan from a reign of terror? Chris, tell us about your time with Within the Blade.
That's so much more time spent on the plot than the game actually does. No, they do actually have an unskippable cutscene going into the game when you start a new one. So you can definitely there's a bad guy. You gotta go kill him. You're a ninja. That's what they do. Okay, but having said so, within the blade is an 8-bit style side scrolling ninja based action platformer. However, before you go and interrupt me and say, I know you're not going to interrupt me, but before you go and say, wait a minute.
Wait a minute.
There's already a ton of action side-scrolling games with ninjas up ends. There was one there's like two or three very famous ones, like, you know, recently, like The Messenger or whatever that other one is that I thought of and couldn't remember the title.
The Receiver?
The Recipient?
The Recipient, yes. So besides The Messenger and The Recipient, the thing that this game does is everything different. So it is a thing where you do run and jump and slash up enemies and stuff in just over the top, like super gore. Like you're slicing enemies in two and you can see like rib bones and stuff like that poking out, and you know, you're just cutting them up like steaks, and it conveys as much of that as it possibly can in 8-bit, which is kind of great.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive how gory the game is. For
it's so gory. Yeah, and it's fast. It's like, you know, it really moves you know, on the Switch and stuff. Like it's, yeah, pretty great like that. Here's the thing. This game, like, does the best job I've ever seen. And I'm somebody who beat Ninja Gaiden 2 in single-digit age. So, like, I love me some ninja platformers. And so I don't say this lightly. This is the game that I think most made me feel like a ninja. Like, and I do mean like an 80s style Western lens kind of ninja, you know, like the kind that we all grew up wanting to be. You know, those, some of us grew up wanting to be Godzilla. Some of us wanted to grow up to be a ninja, and you know, only a few ever achieve those dreams. So because this game, has kind of an RPG element where defeating these enemies and just, you know, drenching the landscape in blood, gives you experience points with which you can unlock, skill trees, like an actual gosh darn RPG. And those skill trees unlock things like assassinate, where if you are ducking, you are sneak mode. You can sneak up on an enemy and push the button that's normally your block button, and your ninja will run in and, without being detected, because there is a detection system, will then, you know, slice the guy's head off or whatever. And thing is, if you can pull this off in the actual stage, because the stages each have you know, different goals, like kind of sub goals, and it might be like kill 10 enemies, or it might be avoid detection, like, you know, only be seen 5 times maximum. And if you can pull those off, you get like a ton of experience points, which is unlocks even more stuff, like, you know, the ability to like dash back and forth like really quickly and slice your blade like there. You also get like that weapon, I can't remember how to actually pronounce it, but you know the kind. It's like the stick with a blade at the end attached to a chain. And you learn like so many different moves and combos for twirling that thing around and just taking off limbs and heads and stuff. And it is just so badass. But like all this stuff has to be unlocked. You also get, I'm not kidding, like 6 different projectile style weapons that you can just switch between. Like, you know, the throwing knives, the ninja stars, the smoke grenades, the actual grenades, and like mines. Like, you get so much cool stuff in this game. And, yeah, it's just really hype because, like, they just, you know, pile in all these dudes and, like, they put them in just the right spot where you can, like, try and sneak up on all of them or, like, take them out from a distance. Like, there's so many creative ways that you can, like, murder everybody. So, and all this against a really good, like, you know, nice pounding 8-bit soundtrack. So, that's all the good stuff. one more good stuff. So, of course, you start the game with a double jump. Why wouldn't you? But you also get a running on the wall kind of third jump. So if you double jump towards a wall and then like push the kind of up and diagonal towards the wall, he'll just go and like run the rest of the way up the wall, like up to a certain distance. And if you do that and you're not up at the top of the thing, then he'll just kind of launch himself in the other direction. And then you can like, if there's another wall there, then you can run up that and then jump across and all kinds of cool, like acrobatic stuff. So my, my complaints are minimal, but it bears saying that there are a couple. One, I mentioned that dash. There's a lot of special moves in this game that require dashing, but the game is also a platformer, so you can end up very often, if you're not well practiced at a particular stage, dashing, let's say, and ending up Wile E. Coyote style in the middle of the air over some spikes. And there's not really much you can do at that point. So there's a there is a strategy to your you know, seemingly bottomless well of cool ninja power. You got to make sure that, you know, you don't end up flinging yourself all over the place, which can happen. But in that sense, I'm kind of like okay with it, because like a real ninja, you actually have to train yourself on how to use these skills. You do have, there's a certain element of get good at this thing. And that's of course on easy difficulty. There's two more difficulties above that, where there's plenty more getting good to do, especially once you start getting to the bosses. They're large and very, very aggressive. Which by the way, there's 25 stages in this game and then 23 bonus stages. So
that's a lot of stages.
There's a lot of stages. Yeah, the 23 are optional. I haven't gotten to them yet, but I saw that they were there. And apparently they are, like, ultra hard. So it's kind of exciting. The other kind of thing about it that I was going to say, and I'm stalling for time. Oh, yeah, I remember now. Okay, so when you get to the end of a stage, it tallies up everybody that you've killed, all the times that you've been seen, and it adds and subtracts like score and money, like accordingly, because you also get money because you can purchase different items. You can also purchase ingredients and recipes and actually craft stuff in this game too, which is kind of cool. There's a hub town that you actually end up in at the end of every
stage. More than 200 recipes. Wow.
Yeah. Lots of stuff to make and lots of characters to talk to. Most of them will sell you like a dozen recipes or so. So anyways, here's the thing. Once you're done with a stage, it adds up all that stuff, tells you your score, you know, your extra bonus experience and stuff. At that point, you can choose to go back to town and, you know, level yourself up, get a new skill, get some new recipes, some new items. You can also choose to just continue to the next stage. Because this is broken up into stages. It's not just one big interconnected world. It's not a Metroidvania. The other choice is to replay the stage. Now, if you replay the stage, you get to keep the experience you already got and plus whatever experience you get on the replay. However, once you go back to town or continue, that stage is done. You don't get to revisit stages.
Therefore,
yeah, that's my one thing where I'm like, ugh. Because I didn't really see how that was necessary. I would want to be replaying the first stage until I have all the moves I want. That's just me, and maybe they're just trying to prevent that. But, yeah, once you start the game, you gotta kind of, you know, you kind of have to figure out, oh, do I want to replay this first stage for the 10th time, or do I want to move on and never visit it again?
Yeah.
You know? Like, personally, I would have liked to be able to go back, but, you know, whatever. It's one of those things where, you know, and that's part of it, is that you have to complete a stage to go back to town to unlock skills. So, you know, you kind of have to, you don't just get to unlock skills anytime and then be like, okay, now I'm satisfied. You kind of have to be like, well, now I have this many points. I guess I can go back and maybe that'll level me up enough. Otherwise, I have to finish this next level with what I've got. So, you know, that's, again, minor complaints, but they do bear knowing if you're going to get into this game. But I do recommend getting into this game because it's super fun.
Well, it is only $10.99. So what are your thoughts on this one?
It's a very easy buy it. I you know, I'm glad I got to review it, because honestly, I was kind of like, I don't know about this ninja platformer. That's, I've got so many ninja platformers and I haven't been beating them. But no, I'm really glad I checked this one out. This is a, this actually does kind of stand out in the crowd. So I do recommend it.
Nice. And if people are on the fence about it, there is a 20% launch discount, I believe, for another week or so, at least on Xbox, I believe on Switch as well. Not too sure about PlayStation, but you could save a couple of bucks and pick it up cheap if you want. So
there you go. Yeah, I get it.
Cool. Next game to talk about is called Restless Night, developed by Huge Pixel, published by Chili Dog Interactive, released July 16th on Xbox One for $4.99. Hordes of zombies and blood-sucking bats, dozens of deadly mutants and cannibals, reanimated maniacs and pumpkin killers. Can you handle these mobs? Cole, tell us about your time with Restless Night.
I could not, in fact, handle the mobs.
Use the cheat code?
No, there's a cheat code?
Did you not know about the cheat code?
No.
It's a Chili Dog game. Of course there's a cheat code.
Oh. Well, you know what, though? If I'd done that, it wouldn't have been a fair review. It is a genuinely difficult game.
Yeah.
It's not... It's a twin stick, and it is very much retro in every way, right down to the CRT scan lines that you can't fucking turn off, and we all know how I feel about that.
I don't think there's any options at all, is there?
None. So,
I don't like four scan lines.
Yeah, that's not a good look, and I'm not a fan, and they need to let you turn that shit off. I would have liked the game a lot more, just with the option to make it look normal, because the retro thing, like, I get what people going for and all that, but some of that shit can be hard on old people like me.
Yeah, I agree, but at the same time, after 2 minutes, I just got used to it.
Yeah, well, yeah, but you probably used the cheat code from the sound of things, so...
Not from the start. I put my legit time into it, and then I got really fucking frustrated with it.
When did you tap out?
I don't remember. I don't remember what stage I was on, because they
got around 14.
There's just so many stages. There's 30 stages to this game, and I want to say that's about 20 too many.
I tapped out around 14. I don't mind like the ongoing twin stick shooter getting swarmed by zombies element. I like that kind of gameplay, so I don't mind it. But I actually thought it was really well done, and that they had like different creatures coming in later levels and stuff. I love crows, and I love anything with crows.
So you're biased.
Yeah. And so like when there were the crows, I was like, no, don't make me shoot my BBs. And it makes you shoot the crows. I concept wise, I don't have any complaints.
It's just execution that bothers me, because I think it is too much of a slog. I think the stages take too long. There's too many enemies, too many waves. Too many enemies in the waves, I should say.
I think for most of the earlier levels, the power-ups help enough with that, though.
In the early levels, yeah.
Yeah.
You tapped out at 14. You didn't get to 30.
No.
The stages just get longer and longer.
Do they?
Yes. The bosses just get excruciatingly long, where, yes, I use the cheat code eventually, and I would just sit there with holding the direction for 5 minutes while it chips away at its health. That's not fun to sit there for 5 minutes. I understand, you're supposed to be dodging. 5 minutes of hitting it directly.
What is the cheat code? Is it like invincibility or something?
It doesn't improve your firepower, which I wish it fucking did. You need that shotgun. You need the shotgun for those later levels. And even when you have that shotgun, the bosses just take forever.
Yeah, I was a fan of the rifle.
They're bullet sponges. The rifle's cool, but it does reduce damage, so it takes even longer to kill things. Yeah, the laser's nice. The shotgun is the only gun that really matters in the later stages.
Yeah.
And if you're doing a boss fight and you don't get the power-ups and you don't get a shotgun right away, it's going to take forever. It's, and it just, it wears out its welcome. Like I said, this is something that's fun in limited doses. The $5 price tag is perfect for it. I think it's too much of a slog, and that's with the invincibility code on.
Damn.
Yeah.
I feel like you did a better review than I did.
Yeah.
But I mean, at least I gave a take without using invincibility.
True. So, I mean, people are going to buy this for the achievements anyway. And I can guarantee there's going to be 50 people getting it for their achievement, because all the achievements in the game are named after community members.
Yeah.
Which I think is really cool.
It's a nice touch. But, you know, eventually you run the risk of something like that with somebody's going to say something racist and canceled. that was a big risk on Chili Dog's part, but here we are.
Fucking Polish people. No.
And then before you know it.
And Zimbabweans.
It's a risk, but hey, at least they, you know, showed they appreciate their community and their fans. Yeah.
Well, $5, what's your verdict?
I'd like to see, I guess on one hand, if you could take into consideration the cheat code and be like, fuck it, why not, right? Mm-hmm. Because otherwise I would be a little more inclined to be like, yeah, it's a try it, but I don't know. I would just really like this. My biggest thing is just let me turn off them fucking scan lines. Like, I was perfectly content to, like, keep slogging through it without the cheat code and just taking my time and getting through. But, I mean, if there's a cheat code, I guess I'll go do that later instead.
go get your 1,000. My biggest, I wish they would just throw achievements in the, or not achievement, throw settings in the game. Let us adjust the volume. Please, God, let us adjust the volume. Let's turn off the scan lines. And you know what? Since it seems so vital to the game to beat it, just put invincibility as a toggle instead of having us put in a cheat code when we want to activate it.
How do you do the cheat code?
Up, up, down, down, up, up, right, left, left, right, Y on the title screen. You should hear a cheer.
Huh.
Yeah, it's the same cheat code that's in, like, all the Chili Dog interactive games. They have, not all of them, but most of them have a cheat code in it, and it's the same
code. Now I need to go see how many of those I have. Like, I bet I've got a whole stash of them that I've just been like, why does everybody keep saying these are easy completions?
Well, speaking of easy completions, the final game to talk about tonight is called My Maite, developed by Uranita Games or Urantia Games, published by Phoenix Reborn Games, released July 2nd on Windows 10 for $4.99, coming soon to Xbox One, will not be a Play Anywhere title, so you will have to rebuy it, but that means separate achievement lists. Maite is a very intelligent girl, but she lives over the moon. This is why her dad has to go there and bring her back to Earth in this 50 stages long incredible adventure. Jump over clouds, balloons, trampolines, and into special portals in order to get to the ending of this pixel art made beautiful game. Chris, tell us about your time with My Maite.
My Maite. It's fun to say. Did you know Maite is the actual first name of Michelle Rodriguez?
Really?
Yeah. Huh. Her real first name is Maite.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
I guess. I mean, her given first name, whatever you would say. Anyways, I found that out while Googling how to pronounce it. but you're ahead of me on that one. So, okay, so My Maite, very simple. This is a single screen platforming puzzle game, you could, I guess, say. You are the dad, and the girl is on the other side of the screen somewhere. And you know, you basically drop down from Earth, which is right above you. It's a very tiny Earth. And then she drops down from the moon, right? And, you have to jump across whatever obstacles are in your way and then get her. And then once you get her, you have to do the same in reverse. You have to jump all the way back to the Earth and then repeat 50 times, or repeat 10 times if you want 1,000 gamer points.
If we'll you get want that the gamer right score, the just do 10 levels.
Yeah, 10 levels. Yeah, and and this one is not Zetalon, right? This is a different...
No, this is Phoenix Reborn Games, new publisher that I know.
Okay, so everybody's like kind of catching on to this whole easy achievements thing, I guess, huh?
I think so, and I think it's going to pay out. This is actually... I think one of the more adorable games that we've seen in this line of easy achievement-ery.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's much
a really
nicer.
Cute looking game. I like the visuals.
Yeah, I do like the visuals. I think they're good. The soundtrack's pretty cute. A little limited. The stages are pretty okay, but here's where, like, of course, this is where this becomes a budget game. Here, for one, no controller support.
Yeah, that was a problem.
Yeah, you cannot use a controller, which I really wanted to, because I literally, due to my overly physical, like, overworking job, and also just a lifetime of having, I guess, a pinched nerve cluster or something between my shoulders, I can't do keyboard and mouse, and I can't control with a keyboard for too long. I found out that has definitely not gone away lately on my Sunday streams, because I've been playing through some old PC games that require mouse and keyboard. Mm. And yeah, it's just killing me. So yeah, that's not cool. And it's especially bad because, there's only one button that you use besides the directional directional buttons, and that's Z to jump. Yeah. Like, it's just, and the other thing about jumping is that there's no holding down the jump button or pushing it lightly. There's only one kind of jump, no matter how you push the button. Therefore, you're kind of like, it's not like a Mario game, which has this kind of satisfying, you know, timing your button presses precisely to where you get the exact distance that you need or whatever. Because you always get the exact same input, you know, the exact same jump out of your input. Therefore, most of the challenge comes from the platforms being placed just too far away or just not far enough, where it just becomes frustrating because you only have that one kind of jump and you can't control it. You can only just push the directional button and hope for the best, or like go to the, you know, the at very pixel edge and like kind of keep running and like just, you know, hopefully that running jump happened on the very last pixel, which you can't always see because sometimes the character's shoes are the exact same color as the background. Although I don't know if this is a way for them to fix that, but like he also kicks up white clouds. And like sometimes that was my visual cue to be like, okay, here's where I can jump because now I can see with the white cloud. But like, it's weird to make your character have shoes the color of outer space. But anyways, you know, it looks cute. It sounds cute. It's got some obvious setbacks, but you know, it's a $5 game.
People are going to buy this for the achievements. We know that.
Yeah. So, you know, if that's your thing, or if you just want like a kind of, you know, very simple, no nonsense platformer that actually does kind of have a bit of nonsense, then yeah, I would say go for it. Cool. But everybody else, try it. Maybe.
Cool. Sounds good.
Yeah.
All right. That is it. Made it through. Took us long enough. Holy shit.
We did it. I would like to make a confession. Yeah, you know, I said there was a puzzle in Death's Door that I was like struggling with to get to a secret. So there's like these portal things all over the place, and I kept seeing them and thought I needed some kind of ability for them. And I just checked the tips and tricks that IGN posted, and apparently all I needed to do was just smash them with my weapon.
Oh, I'm proud of you.
Nice. So I have gone through the whole game seeing these secrets, and all I needed to do was just hit them.
I am so proud of you.
So I guess I'll go do that tonight.
Man, you ruined your gamer girl credit for that.
So what about her cosplay credits?
Yeah,
you're LARPing.
Especially your cosplay credit.
Gamer girl.
Oh, man. Well, that is it for this episode. We made it through another. Thanks to y'all three for being here, hanging out. Thanks to Tim for being here, doing his thing. And another big thanks to Thomas Keene for coming on, chatting about Unknown Number. Keep your eyes peeled on their website for more information on that game. And hopefully we'll get to cover it when there's a playable demo.
Yes.
Because that is a pretty cool concept, and I am eager to hear and see more.
I just want to know if it's going to react to my accent.
I hope so.
I just want to have to say pa once.
Oh, Lord. Well, that's it for this episode. We're done. Anyone have any final words to end it?
Dust my hands off and get me a drink. I'm good.
Pernell's drunk again.
Yeah.
Drunk on tea. That's the first.